He's got a twister. Oh!
Final seconds of the round.
He's got it!
Oh! Chan Sung Jung by submission!
We might never see him again. He made so much money tonight. You might never see Nate Diaz ever again.
Taking a clear substance in a blue vial from a friend that came from Thailand with a fighter of your stature might not be a good move.
No.
Holly, you just fought one of the most spectacular championship-winning fights I have ever seen.
He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth!
Hello.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
Good. You picked up this time.
I didn't know you were calling me. I didn't realize it. I had the lap. Yeah, it's complicated.
No, sorry. It gave me time to change the ringtone sound. It was making this beep sound over and over again, and I'm like, that doesn't sound like a telephone. So now it sounds like a telephone.
Okay.
That's all I got, yeah.
Nice. Well, welcome to MMA and stuff on halfguarded.com. where we cover all the news in mixed martial arts, and when time allows, we even discuss stuff. My name is Matt Grady, and I know you get upset when I say this, but I am joined by Michael Coughlin from somewhere outside of Chicago, Illinois. This week we will talk UFC Fight Night 104, UFC's schedule in 2017, the memoirs of Paige VanZant, key departures from World Series of Fighting, another USADA failure, and UFC 208 coming up this weekend. So without any further ado, I figured we could get into UFC Fight Night from this past weekend, which was Korean Zombie versus Dennis Bermudez. The show took place on Saturday, February 4th at the Honda Center in Houston, Texas. It was a gate of 611,000. And an attendance of 8,119. The show did really well in the ratings, somewhat surprisingly, considering the main event didn't have a lot of name value. It did the biggest number for a UFC show on Fox Sports 1 in a year, bringing in 1.1 million viewers, which is the highest rating since their show last year of Super Bowl weekend, which I think was the Johnny Hendricks fight. So good news there for UFC. Despite, you know, the lack of McGregor and Ronda, they're still doing well as far as ratings go. In the main event, the Korean Zombie, which is what he likes to go by. A couple of reporters asked him, how should we refer to you? And I think even Brian Stan asked him, and he said during commentary that they should call him Zombie. So I'm going to go with the man's wishes and call him Zombie as well. He took some shots from Bermudez early, but kept on coming, typical of him. It was definitely an impressive return. He won by KO in the first round, 249 in. Real impressive considering he's been out 3.5 years, and Bermudez is a top 10 guy at 145 pounds. What did you think of Mr. Zombie's performance?
I thought it was as good a performance as he's ever had in his entire career, with the exception of maybe the 6-second knockout of Mark Hominick. I mean, you know, he fought. Yeah, he got hit a little bit. People say, oh, he's a little rusty or whatever. But no, I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's just that's how he fought in his prime. He's going to kind of wade in, take a shot to give a shot. And he landed a beautiful step-in uppercut, timing it on Bermudez's jab, flattened Bermudez. It's not like Bermudez did it wasn't like it was like a complete overwhelming one-sided affair prior to that either. You know, Bermudez didn't get takedowns like he wanted to. Zombie landed a number of shots here and there. He's still under 30. And that's what's crazy. He's under 30. He made it to the UFC. He's got tons of skills. And they even kind of brought it up a little bit on commentary, but he hasn't fought in all these years. All he's been doing is training and getting healthy. Apparently, he had a desk job, which if you're going to get drafted into the military and you're a world-class fighter and they put you at a desk, that seems like a bit of a waste, but whatever. Korean Zombie, you know, he's right there again. You know, he's top 10 already.
Yeah, absolutely. He took some shots, too. It wasn't like he just blitzed Bermudez. So he's still got the chin, clearly, which is kind of his hallmark. And obviously he was the number one contender for Aldo, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. So he was a top five guy, and maybe he still can be. Anybody in particular you'd like to see him fight next?
Nobody jumps out at me. My instinct is always just to find somebody that I think would be willing to, you know, have a crazy fight with him. You know, Cub Swanson comes to mind. Ricardo Lamas is always in my tip of my tongue. Ideally, one day, and I don't think I would do it now because it wouldn't be fair to Korean Zombie, but him and Doo Hoo Choi, this Korean Superboy, that's just got, like, epic fight of the decade written all over it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Cub Swanson might be a fun fight, too. I know some people were talking Jeremy Stevens, so we'll see what they do with him next. There's always been this theory in MMA about ring rust. You know, if you're out for over a year and you haven't really had a real fight, being in the cage and actually training, they're not the same thing. The speed is different. You're not really getting hit full force. Do you think guys like Korean Zombie and the other big one has always been Dominic Cruz? He says he does not believe in ring rust. He thinks it's a bunch of crap. At least he claims it is. Maybe he does that to hype himself up. But what do you think about ring rust? Like somebody like Ronda who takes off over a year, do you think it affects them or is it different for every fighter?
The easy out is to say it's different for every fighter. I would say that there's always going to be outliers no matter what. There's always going to be guys that doesn't bother them. And then there's going to be guys that the opposite bothers them. You know, I mean, Donald Cerrone's fighting too much and some guys fight too little. I think that the more experienced you get, and not just in terms of number of wins, because Ronda had all of her wins, but she had, like, you know, what, 20 minutes of total fight time or something like that before she lost. I would think guys like Dominic Cruz, who not just had, you know, been at the elite level, having fought and trained for a number of years, but had also been in a lot of very close, tough, gritty fights, they're, I would guess, less likely to succumb to ring rust than somebody like Ronda, who'd never really kind of been in a real fight, basically in their entire career. I think it's like anything, the longer you do it, the less likely it is to affect you. But that's also a bit of a selection bias, because if you do MMA for a long time, by definition, you're going to be good, especially if you're good enough that you can take time off and just train. You're going to be a very good fighter anyway. So if Dominic Cruz comes back without ring rust, that's just because he's Dominic Cruz. Whereas if I took 3 years off and multiple surgeries, I wouldn't come back very good because I wasn't very good to begin with.
That's true. Very true. I mean, the other one I was thinking too, and it's not a real fair example too, was Brock coming back for the Hunt fight. That was over a 3-year layoff as well. And he, I mean, granted his striking wasn't much, but he did enough to win the fight and take it to the ground. So,
and, you know, you could see guys like BJ Penn also who are, you know, people would probably say ring rust for him, but I don't know. You know, his last two fights both came after significant breaks.
True.
But it's also BJ Penn where, you know, even in his prime, he was subject to just looking like shit on a random day.
In the semi-main event, Felice Herrig defeated Alexa Grasso by unanimous decision, 29-28, 29-28, and 30-27. It was a competitive fight, but kind of dull. There wasn't a lot going on. To me, it was Herrig having the experience and size edge, and she was a little more active. Grasso just wasn't aggressive enough. She really just needed to push a little more, and for whatever reason, she did not have it on Saturday night.
Now, the fight sucked ass. It was boring. It was, I think you just nailed it right there. It was Felice Herring just has more experience, and she had more size. She was clearly, she looked like a different weight class, which she probably is. I don't think she's necessarily more technically talented, but yeah, Grasso needed to engage more, needed to press more. She got a little too cute, and I think that's an example of somebody that doesn't have a lot of experience because she probably has a bit of a gym mentality where you're not getting hurt, your opponent's not really getting hurt, so you're just kind of focused on getting in your shots, and you're not really thinking all the way through as far as, like, I got to win this round, and I'm behind, or am I doing enough for the judges? You're just kind of in, you know, you hit me, I hit you, I'm going to do my best. But you're not, you don't have that, you know, basically she's very technical, but she doesn't have, she's not a fighter yet. And it's, you know, kind of a bit of a cop-out. That's the phrase for today. But, yeah, she's got to learn to just fight more. There's something to MMA and boxing, sometimes even, where you just bite down and you got to just swing wild.
Yeah, and she did not have any intention to do that. And in the past she has. I always felt like she was more of an action fighter, but not on this night at all. Kind of a bummer for the UFC because I know they were kind of grooming her to be the next, I don't want to say star at 115 pounds, but they did have high hopes for her, and losing to Herrig is
it won't
kind
hurt.
Of a – I mean, it's a stumbling block. I mean, it's not going to kill
It's a stumbling block,
her, but
it's also Herring where she's got a reputation as being much better than she actually is. Like, a win over her kind of matters and means something to people. So, therefore, I think a loss doesn't really hurt too much because it's also women's MMA where nobody's really – you know, there's just not enough history to say this is this level, this is that level. Like, and you know, with the men, we kind of we have a very good idea of what level of fighter you are based on who you beat and don't beat. In women's MMA, I mean, shit, we've talked about it recently with Ronda Rousey, where yeah, she lost her last two fights, but I'm looking at people like Juliana Peña, and I'm like, nah, she'd smoke her. So it's just so fluid as far as how the division's concerned. And if you're attractive, you have a leg up, as both women do.
Prior to that, James Vick defeated Abel Trujillo with a submission, Darce choke, at 49 seconds in the third round. Vick was just I don't know if he was a superior striker, but he was superior pretty much everywhere. Was able to get a couple takedowns, tried the Darce several times in the second before locking it up in the third. Impressive win for him, but again, it was over a guy a lot of people don't know on a show. On a fight night show.
Yeah, I mean, it's the level James Vick. Sorry, Atlanta. James Vick is at right now. You know, Abel Trujillo is a dude that I think he's kind of fits into the people always expect really great things out of him category, but when you really get down to it, he just has like a He-Man action figure body, so we think he's going to be great, and he just isn't.
Then we had Volkan Ozdemir defeating Ovin St. Preux, OSP, by split decision. Boring fight, not much to say there. OSP probably should win that fight most of the time, but there's something about him striking where he's just missing something, I feel like. It seems, I don't know what the deal is with OSP, but that was a fight he should have won against a guy who's, I think, only fought once in the UFC prior to this, maybe, or was a last-minute replacement, but... either way, another disappointing loss for OSP, and that's, I want to say, three in a row now for him. Prior to that, in a heavyweight fight, a guy named Marcel Fortuna defeated Anthony Hamilton by knockout at 3:10 of the first round. Fortuna's probably like the smallest heavyweight you'll ever see in the UFC. He weighed in at 210 pounds for this fight and was outweighed by like 45 pounds and still managed to get a knockout, so good on him. And then in the opener of the main card, we had Jessica Andrade defeating Angela Hill by unanimous decision, 30-27 on all three cards. Most people think this will make Andrade the number one contender for Joanna Jędrzejczyk. You think that'll be the direction UFC goes?
If I'm the UFC, yeah. She's looked outstanding at strawweight, which she and Angela Hill did on Saturday. You have fights like Miesha Tate and Holly Holm, which was really dramatic and an amazing fight. But this is kind of hyperbole, but I've watched the fight a bunch of times since, and it's been a week almost. This is, to me, one of the greatest fights in women's MMA history. Like, you never see women have fights like this. Like, this is Bonner Griffin type of just, you know, Diego and Gilbert Melendez, or Diego and anyone. But Diego and Gilbert were just swinging and letting it go, but they were technical. They landed big shots, and Draj landed shots that I don't know how Hill was standing, because I sure as hell wouldn't have been. And, I mean, again, Andrade now has three in a row at strawweight. One of the fights is, I think, one of the greatest fights in women's history. Easily one of the better fights you're going to probably see this year. It's not like there's anybody else. I mean, actually, there's a bunch of chicks kind of at strawweight, but I think that you can't really go, you know, I think Michelle Watterson just probably needs one more fight, and Rose maybe as well, and I think Andrade just looks like such a fucking killer, and I mean, I love the chick. She's like one of my favorite fighters in the company right now, so I'm a little biased, but yeah, I think she should go out there and knock Yona's head off.
Yeah, I mean, to me, she's pretty much the number one contender right now, considering who else is in line in the rankings ahead of her. They've already fought Yolanda, so to me, that would be the play, and maybe do Rose Namajunas versus Michelle Waterson. One thing I noticed today was Waterson was in Brooklyn doing an open workout. It seems like UFC is getting behind her and kind of building her up. I don't think she deserves the next title shot, but the way they've been promoting and booking fights lately, I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, yeah, she has like her own show on Fight Pass called Fight Mom and stuff like that. And I mean, I don't think she should get a title shot either. You know, when your UFC career is what Angela Magana and Paige VanZant, these aren't exactly huge victories. That said, she was, you know, the atomweight champion in Invicta. She's been around for a long time. She's not a Paige VanZant type where she's just getting to the UFC really young. She's pretty. She's in the UFC because she's pretty, but she's also paid her dues. So they could probably make it work, and it wouldn't be an affront or anything like that, just because she does have a very lengthy record to her. Most of it at a lighter weight class, but it's still, to me, it's Jessica Andrade. The only reason you would probably do Waterson before Andrade is that, I don't know, man, with fucking Andrade as champion, somebody like Michelle Waterson's going to die.
Right, well, that's what I was going to say. If those two fought, Andrade would be a huge favorite and likely destroy Waterson. So, I mean, I'd like to see Waterson get one more win, but we're in a it's been the dawn of a new era here the last few months. So,
you know what they should do? They should have Andrade and Jacek fight for the title, and on the same show have Waterson and
Namajunas, maybe?
Rose Namajunas fight for an interim title. Just get it out of the way. Just get it out of the way, you know.
Because that's not a bad idea.
There could be upwards of a half an hour to 45 minutes without a known champion. So just go with it.
I'm with you. Anybody else on the undercard catch your eye?
The fights were kind of up and down. Some things were really, really fun. Some weren't. We had a fluke injury. Mr. Razorblades won because Milstead's knee twisted out. Chaz Skelly, he looked all right. I'm trying to think.
That knee from Roundtree in the opener on Fight Pass, that thing was brutal.
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah, that was scary. That was really good.
I thought he hit him with a second one when he was already out, but it seemed like the announcers on the replay thought it was to the chest, but it looked like he kneed him once in the head, knocked him out, and then kneed him again on his way down right in the face. But
that's what I saw too.
Yeah.
They said, and honestly, when you kind of look at the replay, I can kind of see, well, okay, maybe it didn't actually hit the head. But in real time, it looked way too close for me. So I, you know, maybe got away with one. And the only other fight, maybe of any note to anyone, would be Tisha Torres, who I guess is now gay.
I think she has been for a little bit.
She's a switcher. I think she's married or some shit like that. Like, she's married to some. Oh, she's married to what's her face?
Is it Pennington?
Fight? Yeah, that's right, Rocky Pennington. Yeah. That's right. I made that joke to you. So yeah, Tisha Torres beat Beck Rawlings pretty one side. Rawlings just doesn't belong in the UFC. She missed weight. She said she can't make weight. She's suddenly got all these pills she's taking or something like that make her retain water or something like that. I don't know. Fuck you. You didn't miss weight by a pound because you retain a lot of water. Like, if you miss by 5 pounds, sure. But I thought you just mistimed your cut, you dumb Aussie jerk. I tried to use a non-gender specific insult.
Good job.
Yeah, I'm a progressive man.
You are. You're really changing and maturing. As far as the Roundtree fight goes, if he knocked him out with that first knee, and he's already on his way down, he knees him again. Like, obviously Jolly wouldn't be able to continue. You would hope they would stop the fight, and would it be a no contest in that case? How do you think they'd handle that?
I don't know.
It's weird, right? It's a cop out.
That's
the theme of the show. Yeah.
Normally, like, it's one thing if you knock someone out and you keep hitting them and you disregard a referee who's trying to clearly break you, then they can posthumously, if you will, probably not the right term, I think they can DQ you or rule it a no contest. I think they can actually DQ you because you're not listening to the ref. But in this, in that case, it wouldn't be a failure to listen to the ref. It would be so quick. I almost wonder if it's kind of like, like the last play of the Super Bowl where everybody's like, oh, that might be a little closer than we thought. Fuck it. Just let it go and look the other way. We all really know what the finish of this thing was anyways, so let's just move on with our lives.
Well, part of the reason I ask is on Tuesday, Sean Wheelock, the commissioner chair, the committee chair of the Association of Boxing Commissions and Combative Sports, they passed the use of instant replay for fight finishing sequences. So basically the proposed rule will be brought to the ABC body and voted on at its annual conference this summer in Connecticut. So it's not in place yet, but the idea is if there's a weird finish, basically the ref can look at an instant replay and, you know, rule on it. Was it a low blow that led to the finish? Was it an illegal knee? Whatever it might have been that was against the rules, they can review it now. Stuff mid-fight, they can't, but if it leads to the finishing sequence, the proposal is that the ref will be able to review it. But would you be in favor or something like that?
I'd have to see how it's implemented. I think a cop-out. But, like, I understand. I don't mind having instant replay. I would prefer it to be a consistent instant replay that happens throughout the fight, where you have a second official reviewing things, and he can relay immediately to the official in the octagon or ring, hey, that was a low blow that hurt that guy, or that was a headbutt. And they do that. They will. I think even now they'll – actually, I don't know if they check. I know the referee will signal if he sees a headbutt causing a cut, which is supposed to indicate that the judges don't score that, even though they're still going to. But to me, if an illegal blow immediately led to the end of a fight, which is very rarely ever happened unless you're Hoist Gracie, the referee reviews it. They're not going to restart the fight. They're just going to rule it no contest.
Right.
So
right.
I don't really understand the point of having, you know, the referee be able to do it immediately when you could just have somebody do it the next day, removing all the emotion and adrenaline. And the official result will be the same, you know, no matter what. So
yeah, I mean, could you think there could be a circumstance where they could continue the fight if something weird happened and it led to, you know, a submission?
In that way,
you could probably continue as long as it's not like a severe, you know, knockout.
Yeah, but even then, as soon as you stop the fight and you have to wait, everybody's adrenaline has dropped. There's been people inside of the octagon. Somebody's probably thrown their mouthpiece in celebration and all these things. Like, yeah. You know, think about, like, how crazy it was when Anderson celebrated against Bisping.
Right.
Now multiply that by somebody actually winning and then undoing it. It would be, again, I reference the Super Bowl. Say the Patriots didn't actually cross the end zone in that last play. They would have had to clear off thousands of people from the field,
right.
Clean the whole thing up. It would have just been so much of a hassle that...
So awesome. I wish that had happened.
He says, as a man living in the Boston area, you're lucky nobody in Boston listens to this. I don't know if they do.
I'm saying I like chaos and weird situations, although that whole game was chaos and weird situations, but we can talk about that later. Speaking of weird situations, if you had to read one MMA fighter's autobiography or biography for that matter, who would it be?
Don Fry.
Does he have one? That sounds like something that should already exist.
It might.
Okay.
Maybe.
And then after Don Fry, probably Paige Van Zandt, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, who better to give life advice than someone that can barely drink?
Right. Like, how long of a book could that even be, do you think?
I mean, if she dedicated 10 pages to every single year of her life, it'd only be 222 pages. Like, that'd be a very short book. So, I mean, in, you know, those first couple of years are just her shitting herself. So there are people who at the age of 22 maybe have something to say. I mean, I joked about it on the site, the piece. At the age of 22, neither Newton nor Einstein had been recognized or published anything. And that's right. Newton and Einstein. Now, yes, there's people like Anne Frank and stuff like that, but she had a very unique circumstance that led to her diary being famous. Paige Van Zandt didn't quite, you know, she grew up in a dance studio in Reno. Not quite like being in Holland as the Nazis marched through town. So,
what audience does that even appeal to? Do you know what I mean? Like, but what's the demo? Like, little girls?
Yeah,
like, are little girls even going to read somebody's autobiography? Like, I don't understand. Like, if you're a book publisher, it's like, oh, maybe you think MMA is hot and Paige Van Zandt is a star based on Dancing with the Stars, but I don't think anybody who watched her dance is going to want to read about her life, and I don't think many MMA fans are, male or female, really. It's just an odd thing at this point in her life at, you know, 22 years old to be coming out with this book. But, hey, if you can make a buck and get somebody to read it, I guess.
I could see this being a case of a publisher not really understanding the industry that they're involved with.
Right.
Because they probably – and this happens a lot. There are these niche industries, and they produce books, and they probably sell decent. Like, you think of all the pro wrestling autobiographies and biographies.
Right.
Like, those did – I'm pretty sure Mick Foley's did very well. Same with The Rock. Like, those actually sold. And let's face it, when The Rock wrote his, he's under 30 or had somebody ghostwrite it. Like, he didn't have anything to really offer, but a little more than her, but not a lot. So they're probably thinking, well – we know she's on Dancing with the Stars, and she did really well. She came in, like, second or something like that. So that's a big deal, and she's in the UFC, and she's doing this and doing that, and maybe she's really popular with all those Dancing with the Star moms and people that read Teen Vogue. And you know what? Maybe she is. Maybe it will sell well. I don't think so, but, you know, if you're a 13-year-old girl and you see somebody who's 22, I mean, when you're a teenager, people in their 20s seem really old.
True.
Like, it's like, oh, 22, my gosh, she's probably had sex and had a beer. Oh, imagine the craziness that she's been through. And, you know, I mean, so maybe it'll appeal to them. It'll probably just, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of pedophiles out there, too, so maybe they want to read it and feel better about themselves.
I'll look forward to your book review. World Series of Fighting is back in the news. We touched on this last week that they sold basically 60% of the company for $25 million to 31 different investors. I remember you commenting that you wouldn't buy pizza with five attorneys. So in theory, we both kind of came to the conclusion that this wasn't a great idea. This week, a few fighters have come out and said they're probably not going to re-sign with World Series of Fighting. And three of those fighters are current champions in World Series of Fighting. David Branch, who is the WSOF middleweight and light heavyweight champ, is now a free agent and says he's not interested in re-signing at all and wants to move on. Branch went 10-0 in WSOF and was probably their, you know, in their top three stars. He held two titles and went 10-0, for crying out loud. Then Marlon Moraes, the bantamweight champ, is also in talks with the UFC. He was rumored that he was going to get on the Buffalo card. That hasn't come to fruition yet, but there's rumors out there. And then it's also being talked about that Justin Gaethje is done and looking to leave WSOF. Where does this leave them if they lose? It's three guys, but actually four of their champions.
Yeah, I mean, of everybody in the company, setting aside guys like Fitch and maybe kind of Paul Harris.
Although Fitch said he was probably retired.
But I mean, think that Fitch and Shields are guys like, okay, if they went back to the UFC, fine. They've been there before. They're kind of at that level. But, yeah, those are the three guys that I would have immediately said, yep, no matter what, those are the three dudes I want to bring into the UFC. I think Branch will have the least amount of success. I think Gagey's will be a solid lightweight, and Moraes, you know, will do well as at the same time. Like, I think they're all people that could go into the UFC and not be embarrassed or anything like that. But the rest of the roster, I mean, shit, half those guys are barely above a barn fight in the middle of Iowa.
But to me, it'd be like if I was one of those champs and I heard, oh, geez, this new company or this new group of investors just pitched in $25 million, maybe I'll look into this a little more. And instead, all of them did – I don't want to say all of them. Gaethje hasn't spoken publicly yet, but – the other two, Branch and Moraes, are like, no, we want to get out. I wonder what that says about the new ownership, that you want to try and get into the UFC in spite of all this crap in the UFC where they're pushing guys, you know, based on their popularity and their looks and not based on, you know, merit really at this point. So it's an interesting turn of events. It makes you wonder what's going on behind the scenes at WSOF.
It could be just as simple as it wouldn't have mattered if Bill Gates bought the thing. If the UFC is going to offer more money, they're going to go. They all know that the UFC is the big show. These guys aren't getting paid that much, I imagine, by World Series of Fighting to begin with. UFC could easily match it if they want, and they'll come in with a better than your average starting out Jamoke deal. So it's probably just as simple as that. Same with Eddie Alvarez leaving Bellator for UFC. When people when their career is on an upward trajectory, the UFC is the biggest opportunity ever to make money. Even if Bellator may offer more of a guarantee, guys moving up always will take the chance of making the huge money. It's only after they've been to the UFC and gotten to their ceiling, a la Ben Henderson, Rory McDonald, and so on, that then they go, I'll take the guaranteed money of Bellator. So, you know, we're a series of fighting. It's done. That's what it exists for. It's always going to have to be a feeder system to the UFC. Otherwise, no, that's just what it is. It doesn't serve any other function.
Hey, Mike, guess what?
Is it really time?
It's time for another Weird USADA story.
Okay, I'm going to hit stop and redo this.
This is 5 fucking stars!
It's USADA news.
Hey.
It's time for USADA, you say?
It sure is.
Yeah. Isn't it smooth how we can just pretend like I just inserted that on the fly?
It'd be even better if you didn't mention it. So, Daniel Omelinchuk tested positive for meldonium back in January of 2016. Do you remember this?
Melodium, you mean?
Or what? I thought it was meldonium,
melodium, the Russian drug that everybody in Russia takes.
Yeah. Anyway, so
UFC owner Maria Sharapova takes it.
She does. Helps her with her second serve. But
is that a thing?
No. Yeah, a second serve is a thing. You miss your first serve, you hit a second, but it wouldn't help her with her second serve.
You mean after they fault, not like the return of the return or something.
No, okay, you get two chances to get your serve.
Right, okay.
Yes. It's a very complex sport.
The scoring doesn't make any sense. What the fuck is 15 and then love? Where does that come from? It's stupid.
I don't know the history of it. Just
why
do you get 7 points for a touchdown? I don't know.
You get six.
You know what I'm saying.
And it's twice as many as a field goal.
Why do they even have field goals? I don't know. Why is the three-point arc where it is? I don't know. It just is what it is.
Because 1 point for a free throw.
Why is the field 100 yards? I don't know.
Well, 100
is what they decided. It was some English guy back in the 1500s decided to call it love. I don't know.
It makes sense to call it 100.
Maybe it was a hippie thing. I don't know.
No,
you know, like
hey,
peace and love?
How long should the field be? 100 yards. 100. That makes sense. Yeah. No. 15 love, 40, I don't know, double deuce and everything. It's some sort of weird.
It's not double deuce, it's just deuce.
Whatever.
All right.
Move on with USADA.
Let's talk more about Daniel Omelinchuk. So anyway, he tested positive for meldonium or however we say it, but USADA found no fault or negligence in his case, even though he tested positive. Like you said, meldonium has popped up frequently in samples collected from athletes from Eastern Europe, and was added to the WADA ban list on January 1st, 2016. Omelinchuk was able to present evidence showing he only used the drug from mid-August to early September 2015, so like the prior summer and fall. The fighter's advisor said that Omelinchuk did not take the substance after that time because he became aware meldonium was going to become a prohibited substance. don't know how he got that insider information, but well, whatever.
He's well ahead of his boss, Maria Sharapova, who didn't know it.
He had an extremely low concentration of meldonium in his urine sample. That, in conjunction with the evidence that he only took the drug in the summer of 2015, was consistent with the fact that he likely ingested it prior to January 1st when it became banned. Therefore, O'Neill and Chuck will not be suspended. While all this has been going on, he's actually fought. He was still allowed to compete in the octagon during this adjudication process, which is odd and something they haven't really done before as far as I know. Like, you tested positive and they still let you fight.
It's because he's appealing it, but yeah.
Even when you appeal, I mean, Jones didn't fight during his appeal process.
No, but in other sports, while you're appealing your suspension, you're eligible to play.
Okay.
Like in baseball, it happens all the time.
But why not just appeal it and draw it out and go fight again? Like, UFC could have had a bunch of guys fight. Have Brock come back real quick. It took 3 months to get that appeals process over with, right?
Well, they needed to find a Russian translator. That takes time. So he had more of an advantage.
Yes. But that's the weird story of the week. He tested positive. They didn't suspend him, and they allowed him to fight while he was still had been flagged for this test.
What's sad is that that's like the least weird thing USADA's ever done, and it's still – yeah, I mean, I can –
it's just inconsistent. Like, I don't have a problem – like, if that's an isolated incident – like, the drug became illegal. He had it in his system after the test. He could have ingested it before it became illegal and still tested positive for it. Sure, that's logical. It makes sense. They should probably hear that out and maybe bend the rules in that situation. But they don't usually. You know what I mean? Plus, other guys have tested positive for it and gotten in trouble.
And also, you're correct in that, unlike baseball or other sports, the idea that you could be possibly a steroid cheat, and then the UFC still lets you fight. Like, setting aside the kind of ethics of it, just from a legal standpoint, for all Mark Hunt bitches and moans, that's a potential landmine. Like, if Omelianchuk had been found guilty, if you will, of using the substance, and the UFC let him fight again, whoever he fought could say, hey, you guys were under notice that this guy was a possible cheater, and you still put him in the cage with me, and I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, he fought three times in 2016. You know what I mean?
It was fucking awesome.
Like, it came out, like, he tested positive for this stuff in January of 16, and he was taking it, he says, in the fall of 15. But he fought Jairus Danio on February 27th, 2016.
I remember that.
But Oleksii Oleinik on July 13th, 2016. And Stefan Struve at UFC 204 in October. So, like, while he's kind of sort of suspended and they're figuring this all out, he fights three times and he got two wins. He beat Danio and he beat Oleinik. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah, that's really weird. I mean, I know other sports do it, but they're not combat sports. It's in theory fair that if he's not been actually found guilty, if he's appealing it, can't hold it against him. But that it took so long, I mean, again, yeah, he fought in February and he failed in January. So they must have, I don't know. I can see if the UFC, if he had one fight, it was like maybe November, the UFC's like, dude, we're really sorry. It's taken so long to get this done. We know you need to make a living. Okay. But no, they're having to fight all the time. I mean, again,
really bizarre.
Again, this is what you would do. Yeah, if it was Brock, you'd be like, all right, dude, here's what's going to happen. You're going to appeal. We're going to stretch this shit out for like 2 years. We're going to just burn through fights. You're going to fight every other month. And we're going to all make a bunch of money, and then you'll be quote unquote suspended. But no, this is Daniel Omelianchuk. Nobody in the world ever went out of their way to risk their company for him. So they must have either not known or really believed that there's no way he is going to be found guilty of it or something. But
I mean, the other question is, why does it take a year? Like, what the hell were they doing? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I can't imagine. He trained for three fights in the meantime and had three fights. That's a long-ass time to figure out when he took meldonium and if he knew about it. Like, that seems like it should be a few phone calls. Although if they're dealing with Russia, maybe that's part of the issue.
I wonder if it is because it is Russia. In that, I mean, God. Yeah, we've seen it where, like, Anderson Silva kind of, he delayed his hearing a little bit because he wanted to take time. That happened.
Oh, you know what? He's actually from Poland. He's not even Russian.
Yeah,
I double checked.
It's all the same. Yeah. I was even worse if you're from Poland. They really don't. They fucking didn't have the excuse of being a Russian cheater. So, I mean, yeah, sometimes these things take a little bit of time, but a year is way too long. Yeah, these things cost a little bit of money. They take a little bit of time to rerun the samples yourselves or whatever. But the Melodium thing, again, WADA has been aware of it. Maria Sharapova failed. A lot of Russians have had that in their system. It's not like this is something obscure. If anything, I would say that the Melodium use within the Eastern Bloc countries is probably the single biggest drug issue that the drug testing community faced all of last year. We saw, you know, with the entire Russian Olympic team being suspended for a little bit, and most of them were probably taking the same thing. So I don't know what's going on with it, but in the end, I guess justice was done.
Yeah, I guess I'd just like it to be more consistent as all. But in another kind of weird segue here, but a group that's often associated with USADA is the Nevada Athletic Commission, and news came out today that the new commissioner actually works for the Fertitta brothers. Stacy Alonso was appointed to the commission by Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval in December and is actually an executive vice president at Station Casinos, the casino group owned by Lorenzo and Frank. The Fertittas still own a silent majority interest in the UFC.
Not majority.
Silent. It's minority. Did I say majority? I meant minority. Yeah. I think it's like 8% each or something. Either way, they still own a chunk of the company, have obviously been heavily involved in the UFC in the past. Granted, they're not anymore. But how does that sort of thing happen? How does the governor of a state appoint somebody to head an athletic commission when they work for the people who own the biggest fighting company in the state, in the world, actually?
Well, it's kind of like how did the one-time executive director of the Athletic Commission vote to legalize UFC and then immediately go and work for the UFC in the name of Mark Ratner?
Right.
Like, it's a very incestuous – it's like all businesses. There's no real good way to do it, because anytime you have regulation – the people who are best equipped to regulate an industry are people that are in the industry. Like, if somebody said, Mike, I need you to regulate the oil industry, I'd be like, okay. So I'd be like, hey, can we build an oil rig here? I'd be like, sure. Somebody would be like,
how do you feel about fracking?
Well, exactly. I'd be like, fracking? Like the swear word in Battlestar? Yeah, I love that show. Go for it. You authorized oil to be built in a graveyard. I'd be like, oh, oops. So, yeah, I mean, the people who are best equipped to do it are the people in the industry.
Sure.
Somebody that's associated with the Fertittas on some level was probably always going to be better than having Pat Lundvall, who just is a bureaucrat. Still, this is really...
It reeks of favoritism.
It's incest.
Because I think, like, I swear I read it, but don't quote me on it, that the Fertittas have donated to Sandoval's campaign, and it just looks bad either way. It's like, what does Stacy Alonso, the executive vice president at Station Casinos, know about fighting? Do you know what I mean? It's not like she worked for the UFC. She runs a casino.
And it may be as simple as this is way beyond the UFC, in that she's, I don't know, fucking one of the Fertittas, or she's just a long time. That's very sexist of me. Probably true. But still, she just may be a long time executive. The Fertittas may have nothing to do with this. She just may be a power player on her own within the state. Mm-hmm. And, she checked the record. She probably donated to the governor as well. And this is her way to get into the world of politics. It's like probably in Nevada, I would imagine, one of the higher profile public positions you can have.
But there's not a lot to really do. Like, you don't really, it's not the Secretary of State's office or something like that where people are going to be really pissed when you fuck up their driver's license. It's like, all she has to do is not, is like not alienate Conor McGregor, and her job is done.
Right. The UFC released their 2017 schedule over the last couple days. At this time, they've got 13 pay-per-views scheduled, which is going to be tough because they haven't, I don't think they've run one yet this year. So they've got to get 13 pay-per-views in through the rest of the year and 41 total events. This is identical to the schedules in 2016 and 2015. Do you think this is too many shows, not enough, or just right?
It's never too many.
I don't mean for you personally. I mean for the brand, the company in general. If they had a show 7 nights a week, it would probably water things down. I mean, what's the right amount, do you think?
Well, given that their last 2 years have been two of the biggest years they've ever had, I think it's safe to say that whether or not this is the ideal number of shows, it's clear that the company is able to do very well with this number of shows. I don't think it matters. We've said it in the past. Everything's said in the past because that's how time works. But if you have Conor McGregor or Brock Lesnar or Ronda Rousey on a pay-per-view, it's going to do a million buys, and it doesn't matter if Dennis Bermudez and the Korean Zombie fought the week before. And it's conversely, Holly Holm and Duranda May are not going to be impacted at all by the fact that there was a fight night with Bermudez and Zombie. They're just going to fail because it's going to fail. So, you know, the big will do big. The small might do a little smaller, but if they're making money, I don't give a shit. I watch shows, and it seems like I don't really ever feel like it's too overwhelming. There's a few weekends here and there where you're like, fucking A, like the insane July schedule where you're like, come on, like, you guys did like 5 shows in 7 days. What the hell? Yeah. But for the most part, like I've said it before, like, I get lost if there's no show on a weekend. I don't know what's going on. Like, my circadian rhythm is off. So I need this so I can sleep well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're an unusual case. I don't know if, you know, your average, normal, well-functioning human being needs 41 shows a year or if they can even keep up with them. Like, you talk about that July weekend, and I felt like, especially 2 years ago, I think was the first one they did it, but it was, like, hard to even keep track of who won what, and a lot of guys just didn't gain traction. They might have had a spectacular win, but you didn't remember it because 2 days later there was another show followed by another show by another show. It's like, I don't even remember what that first show was or what was going on. I think there's a sweet spot, and I think they're close to pushing it. Obviously, they're doing well. They're making a lot of money. What they're doing is working. I'm not saying necessarily cut back 10 shows, but I'm definitely not saying add 10 shows either, because at a certain point – things just don't resonate as much.
Yeah, you know what, though? I think there's also something that people don't need to watch every show to still feel invested in the product. It's not quite – it's not WWE where, you know, every week you see the same people. You're realistically – they kind of run like 3 or 4 different shows a year, and they repeat them. You're only going to get to see, you know – Conor McGregor fight 2 to 4 times a year at most. And so, you know, if you're a Conor fan and that's all you care about, great. That's what you get to see. If you like Korean Zombie, he's only going to fight a couple times a year. So they're really built in, I think, to absorb more shows because they're just not going to ever appear to be stale as far as what you see week in and week out.
Speaking of shows coming up, we've got UFC 211 on May 13th in Dallas. We've got a main event for that show. It's Stipe Miocic defending his heavyweight championship against Junior Dos Santos, which is interesting, and I think we've mentioned this before. JDS was actually scheduled to fight Stefan Struve, but Struve pulled out from that Halifax card. So somehow Dos Santos has jumped the line ahead of Caín and Fabricio Werdum. And actually the co-main event right now of that show, or semi-main event, is Fabricio Werdum versus Ben Rothwell. So Caín is just kind of left out in the cold, and Junior Dos Santos gets this title fight that he wasn't even really scheduled for or in line for. It was presumed the winner of Werdum and Velasquez would get that next title shot.
Yeah, you know, it works, though. Dos Anjos getting the title shot. He's won some fights lately. Verdum, you know, lost brutally and then had a horrible performance against a horrible fighter. And Velasquez is Humpty Dumpty, and nobody's even bothering to put him together again. So if Dos Anjos wants to fight, that's a good joke. If they wanted to go with Dos Anjos, that works for me. You have Verdum in the semi-main event and Ben Rothwell. But Verdum's right there, so if somebody gets injured, they get somebody to step in. And
right. To me, that's what that screamed of. It's a backup plan.
And you know what? Dos Anjos was Miosic's last loss, so they can sell that. Everybody knows him. He's a lovable, affable human being. If my dad was alive and he's Brazilian and younger than me, I'd want him to be Dos Anjos. I don't know if he's younger than me. He might be. I don't know. I have a birthday coming up. So.
Yes, you've mentioned that.
Oh,
cool. Happy birthday.
Yeah, you motherfucker.
I would love to see a healthy Velasquez versus Miocic. To me, that's like the best fight in the heavyweight division right now. Like, I don't want to say I'm biased towards Kane, but when he's healthy, he's the best heavyweight on earth, best heavyweight ever. The question is, can he get into the cage healthy, or is he going to get too beat up in training to actually get there? That's always the question with him.
Him and Stipe would be, I think, the highest level fight in heavyweight history.
Right. I mean, the junior fights were good. Obviously, Kane was hurt for the first one, but that second fight, you felt like those were the two best heavyweights in their primes, healthy, going at it. Like, to me, the first one was disappointing because Kane went into it hurt, of course. But those second two fights, Kane obviously beat him up and was the superior fighter in both of them. But those were the two best heavyweight fights, I think, ever, probably, as far as a skill level. I don't know if Stipe now is as good as Dos Anjos was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, he may not be, but either way, it's the best possible fight that's viable right now. But after that, I'll take Dos Anjos. That's fine.
Sure. Where do you think this leaves Kane?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
I know he just had surgery.
Just give him Ngannou. Just do it.
Honestly, that might be the guy to do it
because you get a title contender either way. If Ngannou just knocks him the F out, it's like you could put him right in there for a title shot against the winner of Miocic and Dos Anjos. Granted, Verdum won't be happy, but maybe Ben Rothwell gets a weird choke. That seems unlikely. But
before.
Or I know, with the babyface assassin who I get confused. Burnett. Yeah, I get him confused with what's his face? The fat guy in Bellator. What's his name? Melvin Gillard. They're very similar. Anyway,
you get Josh Burnett and Melvin Gillard.
Yeah, because we've talked about this the last 3 weeks. Because Gillard is the young assassin and Barnett is the babyface assassin, and they have such similar fighting styles and look so much alike, it's easy to confuse them.
All right, let's go on.
Either way, Kane and Ngannou, whoever wins that fight could be in line for a title shot. It would work.
Yes.
Another fight rumored for UFC 211, but doesn't look like it's going to happen, is Nate Diaz versus Eddie Alvarez. Diaz does not seem to be happy with the offer UFC has given him, though. He's kind of mocked it online and talked some stuff about Dana and saying it's not worth his while and they're not going to pay him enough. For me, this is a fight that kind of makes sense for Diaz. I mean, Eddie Alvarez is, you know, the number two or three guy in the lightweight division. He's coming off the McGregor fight. Granted, he lost, but he gained some name recognition there in the build to that fight and after the fight, even though he got smoked. To me, it's a good fight. It'd be an action fight. Alvarez is a name. It's just, again.
The Half-Guarded Hour here at HalfGuarded.com is proudly brought to you by our sponsor, smoking. While we cannot legally tell people under the age of 18 to smoke, we can say that anyone between the ages of 14 and 23 instantly looks cooler if they do. So when you're thinking about your future, don't. Instead, grab a pack, light up, and look like the badass you always imagined yourself to be. Sure, one day you'll be drowning your own fluids, but that's later. And this is now. Smoking. It's not a habit. It's just cool.
Heard a commercial maybe, or if I give
it was it the smoking one?
That's the only commercial I got so far.
Wasn't there some fake weird restaurant one you were doing? That was good.
Those I just do off the top of my head.
You're such a good ad libber. So, Diaz versus Alvarez.
I don't care.
A good fight. No, what's wrong with you?
No, I do like it. It's a perfect fight. I think for Nate, realistically, this is the exact fight that he should have. I don't think he deserves anything bigger or better. I just think Nate's going to be a weirdo because they're weird. And in the meantime, Eddie will get, you know, I know. That's just
sounds like my analysis.
But it's just, you know, it's the Diaz brothers. As much as I love them, at a certain time, some point, he's just like, just shut the fuck up. Like, stop whining. Just fucking fight. Like, you're like $20 million? Really? How delusional are you fucking mutts? You think you're going to get $20 million fucking dollars if you're not fighting Conor McGregor? You want You think anybody's going to pay you $20 million to fight Eddie Alvarez? No. You should be headlining a fight night. Like, you know, you did before. No, actually, you know what, Nate? You didn't even headline a fight night before you fought Conor. You were in this, like, semi-main event or third from the top or some shit. You beat Michael Johnson. So just, you want to get your money? Fine, I get it. Everybody wants to get paid, but I'm just so, whatever. Some days I care, and some days I've been very listless all day, and I don't know what's up. So fuck off, Nate.
There's two things with it, I would say. One, You always negotiate high, and you plan on coming down. You meet somewhere in the middle. So he's just negotiating really, really high, you know, and maybe he gets whatever. But the real question is, how big of a draw is he now? Like, I've been thinking about
this. We talked about this last week. I know we did.
I don't know. I think we might have just
– no, because I specifically said that Nate makes him go from, like, $300,000 to $450,000.
Yeah, I think he might be bigger against the right guy.
Yeah, against the right guy. But of all the things I remember, this is what I remember.
But I think this was more like just not texting, but whatever, Facebook. To me, if you stop and think about it, right now, at this moment, Ronda's retired. You've got Conor, who God only knows what kind of crap he's going to pull. Nate's their biggest star. Do you know what I mean?
John Jones.
Maybe, but John Jones was never in back-to-back fights that did 1.5 million buys.
No, but John Jones did very big buys with a variety of people. Nate never did shit without Conor McGregor.
I agree, but I think coming off that McGregor fight, Nate's a bigger star than Jones is. He just is. I think he's got
If Nate Diaz fought the lightweight version of Daniel Cormier, I don't think it does 900,000 buys.
If they had a fight at a press conference, it probably would, and they talk shit on ESPN, it might.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah, he's a big star.
I think he's a bigger deal than anybody's given him credit for. Look at it this way. UFC 205, the first show in New York City, MSG, that loaded card, did 400,000 less buys than the Diaz fights.
I wonder if that's because of the election. I wonder if they just get swallowed up by all that coverage in hindsight.
Maybe.
The election was like, it wasn't just an election. This was something like, even months later, every single day all anyone talks about is what's going on. I've never seen everybody in America so politically engaged in my life. And it started that day. So what we can say is that Donald Trump cost the UFC millions. Way to go, Donald. Way to go. Thanks, Trump.
Well, the other way you can look at it, too, I know you're not buying what I'm trying to sell you here, but I do – I'm not trying to build up Nate Diaz. I truly think he's a big deal at this point.
Okay, I'll be fair. He's – the second fight between him and Conor, that was a much bigger fight than Eddie Alvarez. In fact, if they had done that fight at UFC 205, maybe it would have done 2 million buys. I think he's obviously bigger than Eddie Alvarez, and you can pretty much gauge, you know, somewhat fairly how big Nate Diaz is, because whatever the difference is between 205 and 202, 202, or is it 201? I don't know, whatever.
202.
202.
Yeah, 2-0 was Lawler and
Woodley.
Woodley. So yeah,
that did not do as well.
No, that.
But hey,
that did pretty well for a racist country, let me tell you.
But even 194, which was Aldo McGregor, did a million, 1,025,000 buys was the final round number. Diaz and McGregor at 196 did 1.3. And then McGregor Diaz 2 did 1.65 million buys. Then Connor drops 350,000 buys for UFC 205, which they were hyping as the biggest show ever. And granted, there were extenuating circumstances with the election, like you said. But Diaz, I don't think coming off of those two huge buy rates is a big deal. And granted, he's not worth $20 million, but he's in the top two or three guys they've got right now is draws. And granted, it hasn't really been tested yet, but going against Alvarez with that name, I wouldn't be surprised with the company as popular as it's been did 750. I really wouldn't.
I think the one thing that Nate needs is he needs some sort of drama behind it. I think if you just have Nate Diaz versus a broomstick, nobody's going to really care. But if the broomsticks talk shit, then they'll watch it. Whereas Conor McGregor can draw a million against a broomstick. But, yeah. I think it's fair to probably say that if, you know, Conor McGregor on his own at his peak is worth, we'll say, 1.2, him and Nate combined, that dynamic is worth another 400,000 or 500,000. Of that, if you want to, I would say maybe a 60-40 split for Conor's favor just because he's going to be a little bit more of a draw in how it was presented. You know, especially 202 with the comeback and all that. That was a lot more, I would say, about Conor. But, you know, it's still, you're talking, even if Nate's, quote, only worth, we'll say, 300,000 extra buys on a pay-per-view, that takes you into probably the 600,000 or 700,000 category, which is, you know, pretty fucking good for a functional retard from 209.
And, I mean, Jones is right there with him, too. But, I mean, I think that OSP fight only did 350 or something. Like, that wasn't a big deal. Granted, OSP isn't a name, but I just think Nate, the Diaz brothers, that whole, I don't want to say gimmick, but that whole gimmick is as game momentum between, you know, Nick being suspended for 5 years and getting that petition going and everything else. It's press, it's publicity, it's name recognition, and I just think it builds. And it's like, I think he'll draw well. I do.
I do too. I think he just needs the right guy, even if it's not a shit talker, if it's somebody elite. Again, Eddie Alvarez works, but at the same time, if somebody says the main event of a pay-per-view is Nate Diaz and Eddie Alvarez, I mean, I guess it'll be for the second interim title, so maybe it'll work. I don't know.
Like, I think you and I know that Nate Diaz forever was a slightly over 500 lightweight and got washed out at welterweight. We know that, but the people who watch the Conor fights don't. The people who add a million buys to a show don't. They saw him destroy Conor in the first fight, come out bloody,
get a text message. I understand.
I'm very popular. Have the line about I'm not surprised, all that stuff. It's like we're still thinking back to when Rory McDonald was suplexing him all over the cage. Like, we remember that, but normal people don't.
That's the second time in this show I can explicitly remember you purposely not swearing.
Did I? Yeah, tonight or just in general?
Just tonight. Like earlier.
I'm very, very professional.
Well, earlier, you know.
My cell phone's beeping and I'm drinking
you
just beer.
Said, I'm not surprised, blank. And then earlier you said effing. I'm like, dude, you can say fuck on this show. Like, the whole website's built around pretty much the word fuck, cock, and balls. So let's go with it.
On Saturday night this week, we have another fucking show. It's UFC 208 from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. Fun main card. This one is not going to draw 750,000 buys. Main event, we have probably the strangest championship fight ever with Holly Holm going up. I'm pretty sure it is.
Jeff Monson.
Hang on. You've got a division that doesn't exist, first of all, with no fighters in it besides the two people fighting for the title. The two people fighting for the title, one is Holly Holm, who's coming off two straight losses at a lower weight class. Then you've got Jermaine de Rondamy, who nobody knows, who doesn't even fight full-time for a career, coming off a win against a strawweight. This is the weirdest title fight in UFC history.
Okay,
it's in a non-existent division. Fight. It's freaking bizarre. The question is, what is home any kind of a draw coming off these two losses? Obviously, a lot of name value off the Ronda Rousey knockout. That's going to be the story of her career. But then the Tate loss, and she lost that other one. Was it Kolkiewicz or whoever it was?
Shevchenko,
I'm sorry. Has she lost a lot of drawing power?
No.
Will we find out? But what do you think this does for buys? Oh, Ronda,
I don't think it does anything for buys.
Does it do 250?
Yeah.
300?
I think it does 250 at least. I think it'll surprise in that. I think the bump that Holly Holm got from beating Ronda, in a very weird way, it put her into the Chuck Liddell level where, you know, you can lose a bunch of fights in a row. She became by far the second biggest name in women's MMA. And she was everywhere. And, like, she was a real star after that fight. Stop whining, dog. And I think, you know, I kind of been thinking about this for a while now. She beat the shit out of Ronda, looked like a goddess. When she fought Miesha Tate, she lost, but one, it was an amazing fight. And if you lose a great fight, that helps you. Also, she was winning the fight. Like, it was a fight where everybody's like, Miesha Tate came from behind. And everybody said over and over again, she came from behind, which implies, you know, that Holly was the better fighter until something weird happened. And, she lost the fight to Shevchenko there here in Chicago, actually, last July. But I don't think a lot of people really saw it. And it wasn't like some dominating, devastating loss where, like, they were playing highlights on ESPN. I bet your average fan doesn't even know about it. And
That was a Fox card. If you remember back, the story coming out of that show was that home was this big draw. I forget what it did for ratings, but that was the one thing I remember about it. Everybody was surprised by how well it actually did. Granted, people may not remember it, but at the time, a lot of people watched that show. I mean, I can figure it
also,
out.
Also, keep in mind that as much as I think the UFC is doing serious damage to themselves long term with all the bullshit interim titles and creating a new title and things like that, they have so many decades of goodwill built up when it comes to having a title shot that they haven't, you know, they're hot-shotting it a la Vince Russo, but Vince Russo's shit worked for a while until it was overdone. And this is, you know, the beginning, right, early stages of having Luger and Hogan and a finger punch of one finger doom punch with Kevin Nash or whatever the fuck it is. I'm mixing a whole bunch of errors. But still, the point still stands. Not that this is going to do huge numbers or anything, but I think it'll do better than people might expect in that. I think it'll do better than a Mighty Mouse pay-per-view, which is on par with the Donald Trump inauguration ceremony. For total viewers, not for buys.
4.6 million viewers for Holmes lost to Shevchenko. But who do you like in the fight? You like Holm?
I've actually been watching a lot of these two. For a while now. Like, I just kind of got into, like, a zone with them, especially Durandame.
Okay.
Holm, when she fought Shevchenko, she got outstruck, and a lot of it was, there was two things. One, Shevchenko had at her disposal the threat of a takedown, and that kept Holly off guard. Plus, Shevchenko basically won that fight using a check right hook, because they both stood southpaw. And Holm just didn't seem to see it coming. And it went for all five rounds, 25 minutes of basically one strike undoing everything Holly Holm had. Durandamé.
Similar.
I just watched Marion Renault fight her. Jermaine Durandamé, she's obviously a high-level striker, a much more versatile striker than Holm. However, as a kickboxer, Durandamé is more of a boxer first, and in a weird twist of fate, Holly Holm in MMA is more of a kicker before a boxer, even though she's a boxer by trade. The game plan for this will all be on its feet unless Holm tries to get to the ground. Durandamé I've never seen her try a takedown. Her takedown defense is okay, but not great. I've never seen Holm really do a takedown either.
but maybe she'll do it because that would be the one area where she probably has a little advantage. On the feet, the game, the path has been laid out from Shevchenko, which is make Holly Holm come at you. She's brilliant on the counter. She likes to fight passively and time things up. But when you make her come at you, she's not as effective. You take away some of her reach, and she'll be, I think, a little bit bigger than Durandamy. But Durandamy, she's fought. You know, she fought Strikeforce at 145. She's not like she's some tiny bantamweight. So I'm actually going to go with Durandamy. Only okay. On the theory of Holm is older and the UFC's having weird shit happen to them. It's all X factors for me picking Durandamy. I think it's going to go five rounds, though, and I don't think people will be particularly excited unless they're super hipsters there in Brooklyn and they're like, yes, it's so boring, it's fun.
That is a theory I haven't heard or seen anywhere, so kudos to you.
You're creating the exclusives here at HalfGuardedDuck.
Yeah, nobody's really mentioned the hipster dynamic, and maybe they'll sway the fighters if they cheer for the right guy or not. I'm guessing the hipster person would probably like to see Derek Brunson beat Anderson Silva in the semi-main event. Silva's last win was in 2012 over Stefan Bonner, so 5 years ago. Brunson is coming off a loss against Robert Whittaker. Can Anderson get back on the winning track here? Is this a good fight for him to get a W?
Yeah, I think Anderson, I mean, he's going to hit the age wall really bad eventually. He's already getting slowed down by the quicksand outside of the moat. I'm mixing a lot of weird metaphors here. But, you know, you look at his fights, okay, Weidman shit happened. Diaz, he beat him, even though it got overturned, so he had that as a win. Bisping, he was, you know, at best the victor, at worst, you know, 50-50 with the current champion. And he took on Cormier on, like, 2 days' notice and did way better against the greatest light heavyweight on the planet, number two, than most people would expect. And Derek Brunson sucks. Like, he's not, like, he's okay, but he's a striker first. He's okay. I actually think, and here's one for you, Anderson Silva's going to win by submission from inside of his guard.
You think Brunson goes for the takedown, he's getting lit up on the feet and then gets subbed, basically?
I don't know if he gets lit up, but I think he'll panic because you'll be in okay. there, and Anderson Silva's got that aura about him. You go, oh, shit, and he'll start bouncing. And even if I think Brunson, if it went to the third round, would probably loosen up a little bit and be like, hey, I got some power, I can deal with this. He'll probably panic a little bit, look at him just going, oh, shit, I'm in there with Anderson Silva. Some guys just have that ability to just overwhelm you, and I haven't seen anything from Derek Brunson that tells me that he can get past those type of feelings like Chris Weidman could. So I think he takes him down, and from there, I think that Anderson has I think maybe the biggest advantage he has in the fight is actually on the ground. I think on the feet, Brunson's got power and can clock a guy. On the ground, I don't see anything from Brunson that I've ever been impressed with, and I think Anderson Silva has shown over the time, particularly with his guard, a very, very good, active, dangerous guard, so that's why I'm picking the Silva submission.
Okay. I was picking the Silva by knockout, so we're on the same page, just different finishes. If Anderson wins this fight, will he get the next middleweight title shot?
No. Yes.
You sure?
No, I'm not sure.
knocks Brunson out in the first round. Destroys him. Lights him up like Chris Leben.
The only way is because Bisping's still champion.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I still don't think he would get it. It would be so tough to... I mean, God, you'd be taking Weidman. You'd be taking Jacare. You'd be taking Romero. You'd be taking Musasi. You'd be taking kind of Tim Bosch. But you'd be
Rockhold,
taking Rockhold. Yeah, you'd probably be taking like half a dozen dudes and just saying, fuck you. Like, right. Especially, I would say, Jacare and Romero, where it's like these are two dudes who have been essentially the number one contender for the title for a long time, and mm-hmm. both of them have been passed up time and time again due to awkward circumstances. But again, if somebody's injured, somebody doesn't line up right, if
Michael Bisping, I mean, Dana seemed pretty clear that he's going to have Bisping and Romero fight, and I think that they're going to, just timing-wise, Anderson would need some time, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Anderson's going to do. He's still old. Like, he's right. Like 42 or some shit. Like
I'm just saying that the way they've been booking lately, they're looking for money fights. They've got nothing. They literally have nothing this year so far as a drawing pay-per-view.
Well, look, they'll probably just have Anderson fight Jacare in an interim title fight. I'm just going to make this joke over and over again because the real world is funnier than fiction now.
I'm not defending that as the route to go. I don't think they should, obviously, since Silva hasn't won a fight in 5 years. But in this era, I would not be surprised, especially if they had Ronda and Connor lined up. I think it would make it less likely if Jones was available to fight and they had some shows that would draw some buys. But I don't see a 500,000 buy show on the horizon anywhere until Connor comes back.
And, you know, it's sad because – and some of it's because it's Bisping and – he hasn't actually really proven himself, especially as champion. Like, if he fights Jacare or Romero, I'm just looking at going, well, he's going to – like, I have no faith in Bisping to be competitive even. But if he's to face Anderson, I'd be like, yeah, I get to see the greatest of all time in a rematch from a really good fight. And they're kind of evenly matched. I would be more interested in that, which is really, we have this weird situation where the champion's just not good enough to fight the best guys in this division to get me excited, but he's also the most interesting guy in the division. So,
and they can sell the fight as Silva's, you know, this great comeback, this rocky story. He beats Derek Brunson, he knocks him out. Granted, he could lose, but we're playing what if. If he beats Brunson convincingly, it's like the spider's back. He's going to get his revenge over Bisping and get his title back. They could sell that. And to the normal casual fan, that's a lot more interesting than Yoel Romero and Gay Jesus. Hey. It just is.
If Anderson does win, if he looks impressive when he wins and he does get the title shot, that will tell you everything you need to know about the power dynamics within the UFC. Because if it was the old school, if it was Fertitta's, he would not get the shot. Dana's not stupid, but there is a point where Dana's just like, nah, fuck this. This guy's not earned a shot. He has one win in the past half decade. I'm not giving him a title shot. Like, last time he won, Barack Obama was just getting sworn in or something like that. Like, I'm not doing it. It's a different world right now. It's Trump's America, so.
The other thing I found interesting to the build to this fight, they've been doing some press because it's a pay-per-view and it's in Brooklyn. Anderson's been saying he wants a fight with Conor McGregor, and he has cut down to 174 pounds as a test cut so he could fight Conor.
Yeah, that's fucking stupid.
Is that, like, the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard of? Like, as far as, like, a size discrepancy? I mean, Silva was good. Granted, he's gotten down to 174. I think he had that Rumble on the Rock show where it was like Jake Shields and, you know, Condit and all those guys before they were in the UFC, even before they were in WEC for that matter. But Silva's gotten down there in weight where he's in the mid-170s. He can get lower, but he's older now, and he's – granted, he might be lying. There's something that irritates me about – the bigger guy challenging the smaller guy. If Conor McGregor was out there saying, I could kick Anderson Silva's ass when he was 30, I'll kick his ass now, I don't care what weight it is. Yeah, that's one thing. But to say, you know what, I can get down low enough where maybe he'll fight me even though I'm the bigger guy, it's like, it's just lame. Like, and I feel like it's kind of sad on Silva's part that he's not relegated to doing that, but even, like, considering it, granted he wants to get paid, but it's like you're going to, like, starve yourself, sweat out all this water, and then fight a guy who fought, let's see, is it 6 weight classes below you at one point in his career? Like, what?
No, it's stupid.
What are you doing?
I mean, first of all, Silva's lying. He's not making 174 if his life depended on it. Just, like, I say this as a very highly skilled combat sports athlete myself, but, you know, when he was fighting at 170 at Rumble in the Rock, I was able to cut down to 148. I couldn't. Okay. I mean, yeah, I'm fat right now because I have a drug problem. But actually, I kicked the Xanax. But, you know, I could. My body physically has just gotten bigger because that's what happens when you're a grown man. You know, you just get bigger. I'm not a tiny little twink anymore. I'm more of a bear. Anderson's just gotten bigger. Frame-wise, there's no way in shit he'd make 170. And even if he did make it, you're absolutely right. It's so bad for the heavier guy to challenge a lighter guy. The only time it would ever be acceptable is if it's one weight class difference and the heavier guy is very good but not great and the lighter guy is, like, the greatest ever. Like, if it were John Jones versus Silva in his prime, I would have been like, Jones could have been like, look, this guy's the greatest man that ever fought. I want to test myself against such skill. Then we'd be like, eh, okay. But, yeah. You're
offered to come down and do it at a catchweight.
Yeah, exactly. If
Jones said, I'll do it at 198. And, you know, at least it seems more like you're willing to give something up to fight the smaller guy.
Yeah.
Granted, Anderson's offering to do that, but
he's not really.
McGregor shouldn't be fighting at 170, let alone 174.
Well, think about this.
Crazy.
McGregor shouldn't really be – I mean, he really shouldn't be fighting at 155. Like, this is not like a lightweight – like, okay, yeah. If he was a true giant lightweight, you know, if it's Gleison Tibau – And Silva's like, I'll meet you 170. Be like, yeah, okay. He wants to meet in middleweight class. Like, this is asking Conor to go up two weight classes from his natural weight class. Like,
right. To fight a guy who fought at 205.
Yeah, I mean, the only people to do that is BJ Penn against Lyoto Machida, and that's basically the size difference.
Yeah.
You know, it really is because Penn is a 45er, Machida's a 205, 185er, and we saw the ridiculous size difference there. And even setting aside the fact that it makes you look like a dumb bully and things like that, I think that if you're Anderson Silva, you should be above calling out Conor McGregor. Like, I understand certain guys calling him out because they're in the weight class like, fuck you, Conor. I'm the best featherweight. I'm the best lightweight. You can't deal with me, whatever. But when you're Anderson Silva, it's like all you're really doing is making Conor look like even bigger of a star. Because this is Anderson Silva, the greatest of all time, a guy who's done millions of buys on pay-per-view, and he's like, I really want to fight that really small guy because he's popular. Like, can you imagine if, like, Mike Tyson was like, yeah, I want to fight Floyd Mayweather. That'd be really fun. People are like, what? No, that's
like De La Hoya. You
know? Exactly, yeah. Well, whatever the time would be. Right. And so I think everybody has the idea of, oh, I'll call out Conor. I'll make a lot of money if I call out Conor. And they're right if they get the fight. But until you get the fight, I just think you look really – you look like a nerd in high school – being like, hey, look at hang on the coattails of the jock or something like that. Like, make your own name, be a star independent of Conor, like Nate is. Like, when Nate calls out Conor, he does it with such authority that it doesn't feel like he's sitting there going, yeah, I want the easy payday. It's like Nate's voice tells me, fuck that fucking Irishman. I'm the fucking star in this company, and I want my respect. I haven't been respected, and that's his whole shtick. You're Anderson Silva. You're the GOAT. You're a god. And you want to beat up the midget? Fuck off.
Prior to that, we've got Ronaldo Jacare Sosa versus Tim Bosch. Middleweight fight. Both guys coming off wins. I think Bosch is coming off two knockout wins. Sosa obviously had that win over Vitor Belfort. Knockout win. Both guys, you know, they've been around a while, but they're still, you know, pretty successful in the middleweight division. I would favor Sosa in this fight. Just because I think he's better everywhere than Bosch. I think he's faster on the feet. Obviously, he's got that jiu-jitsu game that's pretty much untouchable in the middleweight division. Thoughts on Bosch and Sosa?
Yeah, I mean, it's Jacare's fight to lose, I would think, on the feet. I mean, look, as a general rule, he's a way better athlete. On the ground, technically, he's above most of the human beings who've ever lived on this planet in pure jiu-jitsu, let alone MMA jiu-jitsu.
Right.
And striking-wise, he's a more technical striker than Bosch. He moves better on his feet. But the one thing Bosch has is just ridiculous power and a great shin. And those are things we've seen, you know, when he fought Yushin Okami. He was getting his ass beat, but because he can take a shot, he was in there, and he just all he needed was the one chance to land something. Jacare could be hit like that. I don't think he will be. I think Jacare will probably end up taking it to the ground and tapping Boach. But, you know, Tim Boach, he's better than he kind of gets credit for. And I think some of it's just because he just looks too normal. Like he's got the receding hairline, the half beard. He's in shape, but he's got like the dad bod, but like a ripped dad bod. Like he's not jacked up, but he's not fat, but he's not skinny either. And he just, you know, he looks like he's just a strong dude. And, I think sometimes people kind of see that and they go, not much of an athlete. And maybe, especially when you compare him to like Jacare, where you look at Jacare, you're like, oh yeah, if I was in great shape and an athlete, I'd want to look like him, not like Tim Boach. But yeah. I still think that Jacare is he's a better athlete and he's technically better, so he wins.
I agree, too. And Boach can never really seem to get over that hump. He'll never be guys, like, ranked ahead of him, if you know what I mean. Like, he's always competitive. He's always around, but it's like Dan Henderson, Talis Latis, Luke Rockhold, Mark Munoz, Kostas Philippou, Phil Davis. Those are all his losses in the UFC. And they're all guys who were probably ranked a little bit ahead of him, a couple spots up, and he just couldn't quite get there to beat him. And I think Jacare is even another level above most of those guys I just mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, look, Tim Boach is like, look, the idea of some foreigner coming into America and taking away our jobs is a horseshit thing. But if there was ever an example, it's Tim Boach and Jacare. Like, Tim Boach is a dude, like, he's your typical just, I'm a hardworking American, and I want to go out there and raise my kids, and I'm really happy my boy likes to do bow and arrow hunting, so he and I do that, and it's good to train where I do right now, because I'm close to my family, I see my kids every day, and that's just a joy to behold, and Jacare's over there and speaking Portuguese, and it just sounds kind of funny, and he looks kind of tan, he's a little black, so you're like, oh, he's going to take away he's taking away our title shots, is what Jacare is doing.
Jared Cannonier is fighting Glover Teixeira on the main card. Thoughts on that fight?
In my mind, for whatever reason,
yeah,
Jared Cannonier has really wide shoulders.
I was just looking at his
He's like a Phil Davis.
He's 5'11". He's 5'11".
Does he look like Phil Davis, kind of, like, physique-wise?
I don't know. I'm going to have to look at pictures of his body.
I mean, I have plenty of pictures of his body. Let me tell you something.
Similar. He's not as freakish, I don't think. But
well, very few men are. I don't care about this fight. Teixeira is what he is. He's a boxer plodding forward. And Cannonier is a really freakishly ripped individual in my head. So I don't care. Glover wins because I know him better.
Sounds good. I mean, obviously, Glover's got the experience edge and has fought better people.
Yeah,
it's one of those fights. It's one of those fights where it's a question of, is the younger guy, less experienced, going to take a step up? And Glover's gotten a little older, and it's over for him. Usually in situations like that, Glover wins. Like, I feel like he always surprises me. I'm like, this has to be the end of it for Glover. And then he pulls out this crazy knockout win. So, obviously, we'll see.
I just looked up a picture of Jared Cannonier, and now I feel really, I feel awkward now because it appears that the biggest resemblance is the fact that both men are black. So this says a lot about me, so I'm just going to shut the fuck up now.
Yeah, I didn't want to say too much about it.
I have a story about black twins.
Is it okay? Do you want to tell it, or am I supposed to ask, or do you just how do we handle situations like this?
So here's how it works. I read this, and the story goes is that there's these two black guys, and they were identical.
Wait, hang on. Is this a story, or is this, like, reality?
It's real.
Okay.
And I add a twist at it. So this is real. Apparently, this really happened. Like, these two black guys, and they were identical twins, and they were in medical school together. And they both became, obviously, doctors at the same time. And they both got jobs at hospitals in the same city, but they were different hospitals. And this woman was seeking drugs, and so she went to the one hospital, and she saw the first black doctor. She's like, she goes through the litany of, I have this, this, and this, all very vague. He goes, I think you're drug seeking. I can't do this. She goes, I've never been so offended. I object to this. This is disgusting, blah, blah, blah. And so then she goes to the next hospital, and she sees a doctor, and it's the guy's twin, who he had just called his twin to let him know what's going on. And so this drug addict woman or whatever shows up and thinks, holy shit, he works at both places. And when I'm sitting there thinking this, all I can think of is, when you see black people that are identical twins, and you don't really know how to, like, tell them apart because they're identical twins, if you're white, you feel really racist all of a sudden. Because all you can think of is, oh, fuck, I can't say they all look the same. That's not cool at all. Yeah, but they do look the same. I'm done.
Do you know on the Patriots, their free safety, Devin McCourty? You probably don't. But he's got a twin brother who also played in the NFL, Jason McCourty. They were in a deodorant commercial together.
Like the Barber Brothers.
Yes.
You remember Tiki Barber, don't you?
Tiki, yeah. You know what was hilarious? I was picturing Tiki Gosen. Like, he has a twin.
I would just think that as a Patriots fan, if there's anybody you'd remember, it's somebody from the New York Football Giants, the only team to beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl.
No, Tiki, he was their running back, and Rondé was like a free safety or something, right?
Yeah, sounds about right. I know Tiki was a running back.
Yeah. Yeah. The other one was Rondé Barber, I think.
They had very smooth heads. They shaved them. Well. Next fight.
In the opener of the main card, we've got Dustin Poirier versus Jim Miller. Fun fight. Two guys have been around a long time. Poirier, I think, is coming off a loss, if memory serves me. He lost to Michael Johnson by knockout back in September. And Jim Miller's coming off a win against, bear with me, three wins. Jim Miller's got three wins in a row at lightweight.
What?
He beat Gomi, Joe Lozon, and Thiago Alves. So maybe he was good. I always say claiming. I should just say he had Lyme disease, and he was blaming some of his sucky performances on the Lyme disease. Like, he was probably out in the woods and a bunch of ticks sucked his blood, because that's what they do. Anyway, he was saying, like, the Chiesa loss and Sanchez loss, he wasn't healthy. So I don't know if that's a BS excuse, but I know Lyme disease can really screw with your immune system and really kind of fuck you up, for lack of a better, more medical term.
It manifests itself with a star-shaped rash on the skin. I learned that from watching House. Usually on the scalp. The idea that Miller has three wins in a row is weird to me, because I thought he was sucked ass and was not that he was bad, but just kind of
done,
more done than Poirier is. And I still think that. I think Miller's taking a lot of fights and a lot of shots, and even if it was Lyme disease that slowed him down, he still got beat up a lot and had Lyme disease for several years. Like, that's a bit of a toll in the system. Plus, I know New Jersey has some foresty areas, but seriously, you live in New Jersey and you got Lyme disease? You're not living in Minnesota or something like that. Come on, you liar.
He liked it. He's into hunting and that shit. He likes it.
And I feel like, if you know, that's fair. And also, I feel like New Jersey would have more Lyme disease than Minnesota because it's Jersey. So, I still think Poirier is just a little younger, a little quicker. And Miller is just a dude that's won a lot of fights by being able to take a lot of punishment. And that doesn't always work out well in the end.
Yeah, and I think Poirier needs to win more. I mean, he was being talked about, you know, a couple fights away from a lightweight title shot until that Johnson fight. The thing people forget about Poirier, he's 20-5, and he's only 28. and he's been fighting the best guys in the world forever. And since he made that move from featherweight up to lightweight, he's been really good. I mean, he's 4-1, and I mean, his losses are Michael Johnson, Conor McGregor, Cub Swanson, Korean Zombie. It's all legit guys. I mean, he's got a win over Max Holloway. He's a good fighter. So yeah, I like Poirier too, just because he's got less you know, miles on the tires, as they say. What Vroom. Else? Anything? Is that Honda or is that Hyundai?
I said I just was doing a car sound.
I know, but that's one of those companies, like catchphrase. Anybody on the undercard? Any fights you're looking forward to on the prelims?
Nick Lentz fights. I know that. Always got to love a Nick Lentz fight. Sure. There was a couple. Actually, the Fox Sports 1 card had one or two fights, Nick Lentz and something else that caught my eye. But
Ian McCall might get to fight finally.
Ian McCall, who lost his chance to fight in the show for a brief period of time. I wonder if he just, like, I was going to say drinks a lot, but I think he's actually a recovering addict. So,
I've heard some sketchy stories with him.
I mean, it looks like a show that it's a shitty birthday present for me. I have to watch it and cover it because everybody else on the site is doing something that night. Fuck. Actually, I just want to be able to watch it and not have to cover it is really what I want to do. So if the coverage sucks, people, three of you listening, fuck off. And I'm hoping it's one of those shows, it's like a sleeper show, and it turns out really good. I don't have high expectations for it because Jacare fights can be boring. Silva can be boring at times. That main event's going to be shit. Jim Miller and Poirier could easily... And it'll probably be decent, but it may not be like set your balls on fire awesome. So, but you know what? You never know. Maybe everybody just goes crazy and has a great fight. I mean, I wouldn't have just guessed that Jessica Andrade and Angela Hill would have had one of the best fights ever. So I just hope that it's good.
McCall is on like the craziest run ever. And I don't mean like losses and wins. Just like canceled fights and him getting hurt or something happening to the opponent. I mean, literally, listen to this. McCall, and this is just off Wikipedia, so whatever. McCall was slated to fight Scott Jorgensen in December of 2013, but was ruled out of the bout due to injury. McCall was expected to face Brad Pickett on March 8th at Fight Night 37 in London, but it was announced that McCall had pulled out of that bout due to injury and was replaced by Neil Seary. The rescheduled bout with Pickett took place on July 19th, 2014, and McCall won the bout by unanimous decision. McCall was expected to face John Lineker in November of 14, and both fighters made weight, but McCall was pulled due to a blood infection. The bout with Lineker eventually took place in January of 15.
Was it Lyme disease?
I don't know. It sounds sketchy to me, though. A rematch with Dustin Ortiz was expected to take place in August of 15. However, McCall pulled out of that fight in late July, citing injury. McCall was expected to face Justin Scoggins in July of 16. However, only 2 days before the event, Scoggins announced he was not going to make the contracted weight. The UFC pulled Scoggins and canceled the bout. McCall was expected to face Ray Borg on September 10th of 2016. However, Borg pulled out of the fight on September 7th, citing an illness. With no time to find a suitable replacement, McCall was removed from that card. McCall was expected to face Neil Seary on November 19th, 2016. However, McCall was pulled from that fight 1 day before it was scheduled to take place. As a result, the bout which was expected to be Seary's last as a professional was scrapped. Like, what kind of career is that where you're always injured or the guy you're going to fight is always injured? He's like, his last five scheduled fights haven't happened.
That's
wild.
I mean, everything.
And it's been like a couple days before. It's not like months out. It's like fight week.
It's one of the craziest things I've ever really heard of in the sport. Like, it's just so fucking crazy. And add on to all that the fact that he beat Mighty Mouse. Like, it was really a draw, but he should have won that fight there in Japan. And since that time, Mighty Mouse has looked like a god, including when he rematched McCall. But still, he's the last guy in the world to make Mighty Mouse look human. And then all the gods have done since then
is take away every chance he ever has to win a fight.
Right. Meanwhile, his last fight was the Lineker fight in 2015. That went to decision. He lost a unanimous decision. But Lineker missed weight by 6 pounds.
It wasn't even a real fight at the weight.
Right. Like, what the hell? Like, that's some... He hasn't fought in 2 years, and his last fight, like, against the best guy, one of the top five guys at the next weight class, went to a decision when he missed weight. Like, Jesus.
Yeah,
like,
you know,
McCall's had some rough luck.
Somebody was probably a murderer in a previous lifetime.
Maybe this lifetime. I shouldn't say that.
With that mustache, I think he's more like a train robber. You got a mustache like that, you rob trains. Maybe the occasional bank if your stagecoach horse needs some more carrots.
Yeah, like maybe something along the Oregon Trail. Like you sneak up on them as they're making their way.
I fucking made an Oregon Trail reference the other day. A friend of mine, her brother, is sadly, he's got like badass fucking PTSD from the Army and all kinds of issues. He lives in, well, he had a kid and a wife in Vegas, but he's recently bought just about like 5 acres of land in the middle of the fucking desert, like miles away, that are just filled with empty mines. And he lives in now he bought a school bus and he's renovated it and put like beds in it, and he lives there. And all I can think of is he's going to die of dysentery or something like that right from Oregon Trail.
Mm. Maybe he will. I don't know.
Don't join the military, everybody. Don't fight and kill people for money. It doesn't end well.
Yeah, in MMA too. Any other thoughts on UFC 208? I think we covered it.
We have covered it and more. All I can say is when I was I went to the Barclays Center once for WWE Raw. It's a very nice area. And as much as I hate New York, some part of me is still drawn towards it. And I think that's a sign of psychosis.
The wrestler?
Well, I said psychosis. No, he did say psychosis. Whatever. His shit with Rey Mysterio and ECW was so good.
It was. I love those matches.
When he returned against Tajiri that one time, that was out of this world awesome.
I went to that ECW reunion show in 2005. That was the greatest show I've ever seen in my life. Me and a buddy, we drove down to New York and saw that show. It was unbelievable.
Was that the one where they had the sign, "If Cena wins, we riot"?
No, I don't think Cena. That was the second one, I think. Okay. I don't think Cena was on that first card. The first card was more like the traditional Heyman. They had the SmackDown guys and the Raw guys up in the balcony, and that Bischoff came out, and there was a legit chant of "fuck you, Bischoff," like deafening through the arena. Like, I've never seen a crowd of human beings like so heated and hating Bischoff and hating WWF, and the show was out of this world. They had like an awesome Mike Awesome Tanaka match, and I think Mysterio and Psychosis fought on it. Guerrero and Benoit. It was just like this crazy show, and the crowd was so hot for it. I think like even it was like the Dudleys versus Terry Funk and Tommy Dreamer in the main event, and like Funk's going through tables and they're lighting stuff on fire. It was just like this one show, this nostalgia show that really worked. And eventually, I mean, they brought the ECW brand back because based off of that show, and it flopped. But best show I've ever seen in my life. Craziest crowd. It was something else. It's also really hot in there, I remember.
I kind of had the same deal here in Chicago when, you know, I saw actually some of the biggest, best pay-per-views in ECW history were here in Chicago.
Sure.
And they were in like September or August of whatever year that was. I was in high school, I think. It's funny because it was at the Villa Park Odeon, which is about 5 minutes away from me. And not only that, I have competed in jiu-jitsu tournaments probably a half dozen times in that exact place since. And yet they had like 7,000 people in there. They had pretty good crowds. And we were obviously the Anarchy Rules pay-per-view when Taz abdicated, well, he lost the title, when Mike Awesome and Tanaka had this crazy-ass fucking throw dudes through tables, and like I can remember where I was sitting. It was, they were all good seats. You know, you pay $20, you got the best seat you could ever dream of, and that's back when wrestling was real. That's all I can really think of.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun at ECW shows. I mean, I could, because ECW wasn't on around here in New England until it was on like Univision, which was like a Spanish channel at the time, late night, like Friday night, midnight, like terrible time slot. But that was later on, probably like 97. So I was actually getting tapes in like 95 and 96. That's how old I am. I was whatever, 15 at the time. But I remember going to some ECW house shows back then, because even though they didn't really have TV around here, they'd still do house shows at, like, you know, your little indoor soccer stadiums or VFWs or whatever it might be. It's like we would get third row for $20. I'd bring my little brother, who was probably 11 or 12 at the time, and I can remember this vividly. It was like Perry Saturn versus Sabu. And Sabu, we were sitting ringside, probably third row, and my brother was standing on a chair so he could see, like, what was going on. Because he was little, he was like 11 years old. Good for him to be at an ECW show, I know. But Sabu did this springboard, like, plancha deal, like, towards Saturn and missed him and knocked my brother right off the chair. Like, and he fell, like, flat, like, on his back. I still remember it because I'm like, holy shit, is he going to, like, I was concerned, like, he was going to be hurt. My mom was going to be pissed. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, why are we bringing him to this? And I'm like, I mean, he just got up. He was fine. He was used to taking power bombs and stuff for me in our basement. So, like, just some of those shows, they were so, you don't want to say wild, but there was something to them that
Heyman
you don't get anymore. Like, even like these Ring of Honor shows and stuff, they just seem like sanitized and you don't want to say corporate, but they don't have that wild feel that ECW had back then.
I mean, when ECW, it was, I can't say right time, right place, but it was also by design. Paul Heyman recognized something. It was part of that whole mid-90s, the alternative rock scene, Nirvana. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had the ability to be dangerous before people realized that, okay, this dangerous stuff has kind of gone too far. Like, yeah, you're Balls Mahoney. You're getting smacked in the head with a chair, and you're not going to sell it. You're a badass, and then you kill yourself and your wife because you have CTE later on. Like, we live in – and it sucks because that world was a lot more fun world to live in. Like, it's more fun to live in the world without the consequences, and now we live in this snowflake world or whatever. And I remember the very first time I ever saw ECW on TV. It was on some over-the-air bullshit channel we had, probably UPN or whatever it was. It was like a midnight show, and my best friend growing up was this guy named Pat Brown, and we would always watch WWF pay-per-views at his place and or his grandma's house next door. And so, yeah, I know. One night after one of the pay-per-views, we watched, and there was ECW on, and we saw it, and the very first person I saw was Tommy Dreamer wearing a Nirvana t-shirt coming out to Man in the Box, and I'm, you know, whatever, 13-year-old kid or some shit, and I just thought, holy shit, this is the coolest thing in the world. It's pro wrestling with cool music. Like, oh, look at that. He's wearing Nirvana. Whoa, man. That's so rebel, man. And, like, it totally hooked me. And, like, even now, like, I was in fucking, like, high school. Keep in mind, I went to a really great high school, but it's all, you know, it was a fucking private Catholic high school. And for my religion class, we had an assignment to, like, bring something from television showing the effects of advertising on people or whatever. And people were bringing, like, Downy commercials or whatever. And I brought in the 1998 Heatwave 98 Living Dead Girl music video they did with Rob Zombie hyping the show up after it had happened or whatever. And I just played that for 2.5 minutes for my fucking religion class. And afterwards, like, I don't even know what I said to justify it. All I knew was at that time in my life, I thought, this is the coolest thing ever. Surely if I show everybody at school this, they'll think I'm really cool and hip. And shockingly, it didn't really work out for me.
It's funny. We used to do backyard wrestling, you know, like 98, 99. like we go through tables and stuff. We were stupid. But, like, I can remember, like, you got to watch the show we just did. Because we thought, like, the actual like wrestling was garbage. We were jumping around on a trampoline, but like the booking was like such a knockoff of like everything we liked. Like we had somebody like Stone Cold, we had a version of Kane and all this stuff, but like me and my buddies would like dress up as like my friend's character was Molten. And that was supposed to be like our version of Kane. We'd make him like dress up as Molten and go around the supermarket because we were trying to like character develop and like have him go to the mall and buy stuff. And he would like open the door to the supermarket with his hand because he had magic powers, but he was really stepping on the automatic door. Like, and we thought it was the funniest, greatest thing ever. And part of me still wants to do a reunion show.
I'm not letting this go. I forced my brother to do backyard and basement wrestling with me. It was always on some bullshit mattress where we had to put used carpeting samples on top of it so the exposed springs wouldn't puncture our lungs or something like that. Brother was like, the poor kid. He had an older brother who is a very dominating personality, shocker, he kind of had to go along with my shit. And he was kind of like, played like an Undertaker type of character. I would play – I was like a Hardy Boys type of character. And then we found this fucking bodysuit, and we found a ninja mask. And we taped it all together and made a wrestling dummy, which we called Southern Justice. And Southern Justice was part of like – sometimes it'd be a tag team, sometimes it'd be a three-way, whatever. Like,
is it based on Jeff Sessions?
I have – well, he wasn't that racist. Although he did have a KKK symbol – on a sheet of paper that he had, pinned to his chest. So, and we all had our own entrance music and light shows and things like that. But the two greatest moments that ever happened in our little three-man, sometimes four or five-man, if a friend came around with a brother we could beat up, Federation, was one, we had this shitty little piece of wood. It was like a long piece of wood, good enough for a table. And this is we were doing this in our unfinished basement, and it had all like truly unfinished, and as in like the big steel girders that hold your house up were exposed and all this.
Sure.
And so, I was on the quote unquote table. My brother was going to jump off of the top rope, which was a folding chair, and he was supposed to like crash through the table. Except for when he jumped up, he just slammed his head into the metal girder, and you could just like see his head stop and his whole like upper torso come up into him, and then he just collapsed through the table, and you just see me like, oh, looking at him, like, and then I immediately run over and turn off the camera. And the other great moment was when we finally decided to move outdoors to the actual backyard, which my parents, living in a very nice upper middle class community on a corner, probably weren't very thrilled with the fact that their kid had dragged a mattress out in the backyard and had two ladders set up for top ropes. And so, but we also had a deck in the backyard. And so we built a match up to this big spot. And the first thing I did was a springboard. I jumped up onto the railing of the deck and I jumped down and hit my brother. And it worked. I'm like, yeah. The railing from the ground, probably like about 7 feet. And then I signaled to the camera. I waved my hand around my head like I'm with a lasso, and I'm woo! And I did the Hardy Boys gun salute, and I ran back up onto the fucking deck, and I ran and I jumped, I springboarded, if you will. I grabbed the railing. I did a front flip to land on my brother, and somewhere there's a videotape of this where my brother looks at it, jumps out of the way.
Like the Miz.
I come crashing down on the ground, ass first, and you can just hear my brother yell out, "Oh shit!" And then I finished the match and I got the pin. So yeah, I'm a worker.
Yeah, my brother's 5 years younger than me, so it's very similar, but probably even worse because, like, at certain points, I could really throw him around, like, you know, belly to bellies, and like really toss him around, and he could give me like Frankensteiners and stuff because he was small and I could hold him and just do like a front flip. But I can remember vividly, we wrestled on a trampoline. He went for like like a spring, like I guess you'd call it a springboard, but like a flip basically. And my buddy didn't catch him. He just let him fall on the ground. Like, he wasn't hurt, but like at this point, like my brother had been wrestling a few times and my mom was getting sick of it. And I was probably 17 or 18. So she's like, whatever, but he's 12. He can't do this anymore. I'm like, oh man. So, but then we create a storyline where his gimmick was that his mom wouldn't allow him to wrestle. So he would like come out and like whine during other people's matches and say he wanted to fight. So we still worked him into it and used him as a ref and stuff. But like we actually worked like stupid shit behind the scenes into the shows. It was ridiculous.
The trampoline reminds me of my best friend I mentioned before, Pat Brown. He had a trampoline at his house in his backyard. And yeah. The two most horrific.
We would move trampolines from one yard to another. Like four of us would carry the trampoline from like a neighbor's yard into the yard we were going to wrestle because they wouldn't let us wrestle in their yard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how screwed up we were.
I remember one time he jumped off the railing of his deck and he was going to do a shooting star press onto the trampoline.
Ooh.
And yes. Yeah, he ended up scorpioning himself on the trampoline. Thank goodness it was on the trampoline itself so he didn't die. And then yeah. Also the trampoline was within jumping distance of his parents' car garage, which is separate from the house. And so I'm like, fuck this. I jumped up on the top of the roof of the garage, and I did a big elbow drop onto a fake dummy. And I bounced so high, and I barely made it on the trampoline. I'm like, oh shit. So my dumbass friend jumps up, gets up to the roof, does a front flip, lands on the trampoline, bounces so high, he ends up landing on the ground, having missed everything on his way down, which is to say that we were the last generation of really dumbass kids, because the tumbler generation doesn't do shit like this.
Yeah, one of the best spots, and it was always unintentional, it's like getting your leg and your balls caught like in the springs between like the frame of the trampoline. You ever do that?
Oh, yeah.
That's good because then your leg's like all bent and mangled and you smashed your balls. Speaking of balls, Tom Brady won another Super Bowl this weekend. I don't even know what you say about this, and obviously I'm probably biased, but I try and remain fair and neutral. Like
Belichick. Fox News.
No, I legit think I'm more fair-minded than most people in this area. I think Belichick probably cheated when he taped those games. I think Brady deflated the balls. I don't think you break your cell phone and there's a bunch of text messages between the ball boys and whatever, your assistants, if that isn't going on. So I think they did some stuff. I think some other teams do some stuff and other teams may not get caught. I'm open to any of that. Bottom line is they've won five Super Bowls. Brady's got four MVPs now. He pretty much orchestrated the greatest comeback in football history, down 28-3 with 6 minutes left in the third quarter of the Super Bowl. No team had ever come back from 10 points in the Super Bowl. They came back from 25. Am I missing anything here, or is that pretty much common knowledge?
To me, there are four guys you can call the greatest quarterbacks of all time, and they're very similar in that you have Brady and Montana versus Marino and Peyton Manning. And,
okay.
You know, I would say that over the course of their career, taking all the games into consideration and not weighting playoff games heavier, I would say Manning is better than Brady just because he just did everything with his team. But If you live in, I think it's fair to say, by the idea that the playoffs are where quarterbacks are really judged and all that stuff, then Brady is way far ahead of Manning, and the only guy close to him is Montana and maybe Terry Bradshaw, but Bradshaw's such a different era. I mean, what Brady's done, I mean, four MVPs in the Super Bowl, five Super Bowls, seven appearances in like the past 15 or 17 years or whatever the fuck it is, like, every other year he's in the Super Bowl, and every 3 or 4 years he's winning it. This is insane. What they did on Sunday was, I mean, it's the greatest Super Bowl victory of all time. It's not the greatest finish ever. The greatest finish ever, I think, was actually when the Patriots beat the Rams and the ball came like an inch short of the goal line. I think that was the Patriots Rams.
Yeah, that was the Titans.
Okay, yeah.
That was a different Super Bowl.
That was one of the greatest finishes ever. But, I mean, to come back like they did, and it's funny because I had to watch the game with my mom, my brother, and my brother's fiance. None of these people watch sports. Like, my mom's in her 60s. She's watched fucking football. She watches the Bears every week. She's like, and then she goes, so the quarterback, he's a thrower, right? What else does he do? I'm like, oh, shit, I don't even know how to explain a lot of this. And my brother and his fiance, they didn't care. My brother knows kind of the basics of the game, but, like, they're all interested in the commercials and shit like that. And, like, I'm watching the game itself, and I'm so glad I did because, yeah, it was like three quarters of just kind of like, oh, okay, whatever, like, this is happening. The Falcons are going to win. Nobody will give a shit because it's the Falcons. Like, Atlanta is the most boring city in America. And then Tom Brady came back, like you said, did the greatest comeback ever, won in the first ever overtime in the history of the Super Bowl. He did all this under the specter of Deflategate, the, I think, bullshit four-game suspension. I think even if he did cheat, 4 games was absurd. He got to stick it to Goodell. They were able to tell Odell Beckham, you had the second greatest catch in Super Bowl history because Edelman now has – I don't
know. Yeah, I think you're thinking of Tyree.
Oh, shit, yeah.
The first – yeah,
that's right. I assume it was Beckham, but he had that one-handed grab. But, I mean, Edelman's catch, it was – I think it's the greatest – it might be the greatest play in NFL history, that catch, just because – and this is a credit to the NFL's production and everything – and for as awful as football can be with all the brain injuries and the guys getting fucked over and cut and no guaranteed contracts, that one moment when the ball was loose and it just seemed to defy the laws of physics, hang in the air, and you could see both of his hands come around to grasp it. You could watch, you could like put yourself in his head and you could visualize everything he saw in that moment of grab the ball, and he did it and he held on. As soon as that happened, I think there was still like 5 minutes to go, I thought, that's it. The Patriots are going to win this thing. That's the kind of thing that happens on Magic teams. And it's sad because Jones and the Falcons had that once-in-a-lifetime catch earlier, which I defied reality. But Edelman's catch there, you don't forget things like that. And at this point, to me, Belichick and Brady, the only people ever close to them were Walsh and Montana. I think Belichick and Brady are even greater. I think they've had stiffer competition. And even if they've, you know, they only have 5 wins, only have 7 Super Bowl appearances. Like, every other year, they're right in it. They're either in the conference finals or the playoffs or whatever. I don't know if Tom Brady's ever not been in the playoffs. It's incredible. So my hat's off to the New England Patriots. You're the greatest football team that's ever existed, and I don't know what to say.
Do you think it's the greatest comeback ever or the greatest choke ever?
Comeback.
You think?
Yeah, I mean, part of this because...
Because, I mean, the one thing... Sorry.
No, you go ahead. I talk too much.
No, sorry. The thing that got a lot of press around here anyway was, obviously local sports radios in Boston, it's going to be a lot different than the other, 95% of the country, was talk that the Falcons were just tired at the end of that game. The Patriots ran 93 plays on offense. The Falcons ran 46. They had all those three and outs and the fumble, and just the defense was on the field chasing the Patriots receivers around for most of the second half. So a lot of people were saying the Falcons were just tired and the Patriots ran twice as many plays, and that's kind of what cost the Falcons the game in the end.
No. What cost them the game was they had the ball in the Patriots, I think, 22 in the fourth quarter, and they ended up losing.
They got pushed back.
Yeah, the 33 yards on the penalties and the sacks. All they had to do was run it 3 times, kick a field goal. The game's probably over. That was fluky, and Tom Brady is Tom Brady. I can't say that anybody chokes against him. I mean, they probably do on some level because they get caught up in the moment. Just like we were saying earlier with Derek Brunson and Anderson Silva. Sometimes you're facing a guy like Tom Brady, and once they get a little momentum, if you're the Falcons, you go, oh, shit, it's Tom Brady. But he's done that to all kinds of people. This isn't the It's not like Tom Brady is, like, only one or two times done this. It's, you know, Joe Montana maybe called the comeback kid, and he did it as great as anybody has. But Brady's done this a couple of times, and, you know, even when they've lost to the Giants or whatever, like, Brady tended to come back, drive the offense down, score what would have been the game-winning touchdown, and get fucked by his defense or whatever. Like, the guy just knows what to do. When you get beat by the greatest quarterback, greatest coach, maybe greatest team that's ever lived, you didn't choke. You got beat by the greatest ever. That's like saying, like, Stephen Bonner choked when he fought Anderson Silva. Like, yeah.
Right. No, I tend to agree with you, because to me it's like, how is it the biggest choke ever when you're the underdog? Like, if the roles were reversed, if the Patriots were up 28-3 in the third quarter and Atlanta came back, it would be the biggest choke ever. There's something different about the underdog losing the game when they had the lead as opposed to the favorite losing the game when they had the lead.
Yeah, and I feel bad for the Falcons, because if history's any – if past is prologue, they're really fucked for a while, because anybody that loses a Super Bowl tends to just suck ass right afterwards.
Mm.
But they got, you know, they have an incredibly dynamic offense. We'll see how it works with Shanahan being gone now, going to the 49ers in that clusterfuck of a situation. But they still, you know, Matty Ryan was the MVP of the league. I wouldn't have voted for him. I thought Tom Brady deserved it. I think his numbers were just as good as anyone else's, and in four fewer games, so credit to him. But, you know, the Falcons play in a shit-ass division. They'll probably be back in the playoffs next year, and unfortunately for them, the Patriots will also, and they'll be the favorites to win the Super Bowl. And right now, when you look at that on paper, you go, who's going to beat them?
Yeah, and I mean, the one other thing with Brady, too, when you're comparing him to Montana, is the players Brady's had around him over the years. There's not a lot of Hall of Fame guys on that team besides Brady. He's got Gronk now, and he had Moss, but they didn't win the Super Bowl with Moss. You're talking about these undersized, like, slot receivers like Edelman and Welker, and you wonder, are those guys really that good, or does Brady make them all better? Because, you know, Montana had Rice. Like, you don't immediately think Brady in this standout wide receiver that he had for most of his career and then continued on after they left the Patriots as a great wide receiver.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of guys. How many Patriots running backs can you name? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know.
Right, because he's on the team now. Oh, but, yeah. I mean, like, they had Corey Dillon, but Dillon was kind of washed up after the Bengals. He was still good, but he wasn't great. They kind of turned his career around a little bit. But, like, the first Super Bowl they won, it was like, Antoine Smith was their running back. Guys you wouldn't even know in a lineup, or if somebody told you. A weaker supporting cast for Brady than Montana had.
I'll say, in defense of Montana, just because I grew up with him as like a boyhood idol, he won his first Super Bowl without Rice. And That was the 1980s, when being a passer, was a quarterback, was far more difficult than today. It's kind of like, to me, that's the big thing in Marino's favor. He set all those records in an era when roughing the passer and pass interference and shit like that wasn't called nearly like it is today. Like, we live in an offensive juggernaut era. It's with the way the rules are scheduled for in favor of quarterbacks, it's kind of like the steroid era of baseball versus the dead ball era. That said, the quarterback is somebody that gets measured by more than just their stats. Football's one of the few games where I will buy into the you can just grit your way through it and be a man. Like, MMA can be the same way. Like, baseball, it doesn't work. Baseball, you have, you know, 600 at-bats a year. You don't just mentally will yourself to win in baseball. It's all about being mechanical and repeating things. Football, you'll see guys who drive the extra yard to get the touchdown on what appears to be nothing but sheer will and adrenaline. And so football is a game of X factors. Tom Brady's been the ultimate X factor for almost two decades now. And what are you going to do when a guy's in the when he's in the Super Bowl almost every other year and he wins it every three or four? I can't argue against that. And I'm not even a Patriots fan.
Well, it was funny. There's a lot of question about if the Patriots lost this game, what would it mean for Brady's legacy? Is he worse than Montana because he went 4-3 in the Super Bowl? It's like, no, Montana went 4-0, but only got there four times. Brady got there three more times than Montana did. Like, that was like the most ludicrous argument ever. Is 4-0 in the Super Bowl better than 4-3 in the Super Bowl? No, it means you didn't get there as many times. You weren't even that good. You, like, lost before the Super Bowl more often than the other guy who got there seven times.
Well,
that argument is dumb, for lack of a better term.
A wordsmith he is, everybody. A wordsmith. Yes. I would say that it would be a little bit of a justified argument against Brady, simply because I just made the point or the argument that you judge quarterbacks a lot on the X factor type of things, and so if you're 4-3 in the Super Bowl, it kind of lessens your special X factor ability to make something happen and be magical that I expect out of a quarterback. It's more like, okay, you have a really good team that got to the Super Bowl a lot, but you're only kind of almost 500. Maybe everybody else would be if they got there too. So if I'm going to give Brady credit for winning it, and I do, I would have probably knocked him a little bit if he lost it. And it's stupid because it's 60 minutes of a career. Shouldn't really matter how you judge a career, but if I'm going to judge him positively because of, actually in his case, almost like basically 15 minutes at the end, if I'm going to give him a lot of credit for that, I think it's fair that I would have knocked him for it, but he didn't do it. Here's the thing. It didn't happen. He did win, and
right.
We don't have to consider that.
Right. I just think losing in the Super Bowl is more impressive than losing in the NFC playoffs or the NFC championship game.
Well, Jim Kelly's a god then.
I wouldn't say he's a god, but he's better than 90% of the quarterbacks of that era, yeah.
I mean, what are the odds of losing four fucking Super Bowls in a row? Oh,
yeah, well,
man.
That one with it where Norwood missed that field goal really sucked. But, yeah, I mean, to me, he's the best that's done it. His record proves it. I think he's got the most wins in NFL history. He's probably going to set the yardage record and the touchdown record eventually. He says he wants to play till he's 45. I don't buy that, but that's what he's claiming he wants to do. So,
if anybody can, it's him. I mean, what I've read about him and the way he takes care of his body, like he's a loser because, I mean – living
best
like,
quarterback ever is a loser, yep.
Yeah, the best quarterback ever, who's a multimillionaire, whose supermodel wife is worth more than him. Yeah, I know. But, like, he's never had a strawberry. He doesn't
eat, he's weird.
He doesn't
yeah.
eat fruit. He only eats, quote, nightshade vegetables. I don't even know what that fucking means. I don't know what a nightshade vegetable is. And the guy is just obsessed like it, but he's... He gets it fucking done. You know, his job is to win, and he wins. And that's all that matters. If he's a weirdo who eats kale and couscous every day, whatever. He's doing what he's supposed to do. And maybe he's not as happy as Brett Favre, you know, sending dick pics to sideline reporters, but he's got Giselle. Fucking Giselle Bündchen is his fucking wife. That, if anybody in the world you knew Mary Giselle, you'd be like, that dude is my hero. If anybody you knew in the world was a five-time Super Bowl winner, you'd be like, that guy's my hero. He combined the two. That's not fair. Fuck you, Brady, you perfect son of a bitch.
Anything else going on in the world that you'd like to bring to our dozens of listeners' attention?
If I bring it up, it's not organic. If you bring it up, it's organic.
I don't think I know.
I set reminders for myself.
Oh boy.
Oh god. Okay. I think they're both important. The Lady Gaga halftime show.
Okay. Did you like her dive? She did a plancha off a roof.
I loved it until I found out it was taped beforehand.
It wasn't a shoot.
No. Like, which I guess makes sense in case it went wrong. But she's been getting a lot of weird reactions from people on this. Like, people on the right are praising her because she didn't make a political statement. People on the left are like, she should have taken the opportunity. And I know what they mean, but I know this sounds weird, but I think she made a statement with what she did. Lady Gaga's not stupid. Like, you might not like her music, whatever, if you have no taste, but she wears, you know, a meat dress and does weird shit. Like, she, even if she's a moron, she still has in her brain the idea of making a statement and telling people things and shit like that. For her to not make a statement was in and of itself a statement. I felt like she went almost ironically over the top with everything. And by not saying, fuck you, Donald Trump, or whatever. Although I thought she did change the lyrics at one point, one of her songs, to include, like, immigrants or something. I don't know. But to not make a statement, in her case, was actually making a statement. Because everybody's talking about it. Like, why didn't she do something? And when she fucking ended her segment by jumping in the air, catching a football while she wears barely anything but football pads and a helmet, catches a ball in midair, and then fireworks explode everywhere. It was so over the top. And for an artist that I know is very self-aware, it had to be deliberate. I'm like, she's ironically doing a halftime show. She's playing up everything people kind of expect and want, and she's teasing everything. She did the part where she was playing the piano, and, like, she threw her leg up, and, like, there it is, because I kept thinking she was going to, like, rip her pants off and be like, look at my vagina, Trump. But she was, like, almost teasing it that way, and I really, truly believe and feel that it was great art. I thought what she did was, like, she played off of people's expectations of her, of what the Super Bowl should be. She did something. It won't be remembered like Prince or Michael Jackson, but it'll be better than whatever bullshit Beyonce did, I think, last year or something like that. So I really thought she did something special artistically. Maybe I'm alone on that, but I do.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the thing she doesn't get enough respect for is she can sing, man. She's a good, like, talented singer. Sometimes you'll hear her do something live, like, she did a couple things on Stern a couple times where you're like, holy shit, she can sing. And you think a lot of these pop stars, you know, the Britney Spears, that sort of thing, where it's a lot of studio work and, you know, post-production. She can sing.
Yeah, and you know, she's in. I know that pop stars like her they're manufactured by design, but I sense that she embraces what she is. Like, there are some of them, they're delusional and think, I'm this brilliant songwriter because I changed a lyric here and there. I think that she sees what she does as, it's more than just the music. Like, I sense like a Britney Spears type is like, they see the music as the only venue for acceptance and respectability. So they pretend that they're these great artists, these great singers, these great lyricists, and so on. Whereas Gaga, much like Michael Jackson before he was raping kids, or maybe during, understands that what she does is singing, but it's also dancing. It's also a spectacle. It's everything. Like, it's a truly artistic performance. And I just thought it was, I'm not like saying, like, it was like the greatest thing I ever saw. Like, I loved it to death, but I thought, that's real art. So, again, I tip my hat to her.
And okay.
If I was in Russia, I could beat her up now without repercussions.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, that's the other thing I set a reminder for. It says, in Soviet Russia, you beat wife, government doesn't beat you, or something like that. But what the fuck is wrong with Russia? Like, of all those dumbass laws to pass, yeah, you can, if you don't leave a mark on your wife, it's okay. What the fuck? Like, even back in the day, they had laws that said you can't beat your wife, but then they looked the other way. Russia's is officially codified by, like, 300-2 voting, and balls out to the two. Yeah.
It might have been the only two women.
No, well, maybe. I know that the chief sponsor of the bill is a woman. And not only is she a woman, she's the one that last year pushed through pushed through the bill that says that any positive portrayal of homosexuality is against the law in Russian in Russia. So I don't know what is going on with Russia. Like, they are not, I can't say they're not part of the West, because, yeah, obviously the West has become very accepting and understanding of progressive causes, you'll say. But even if you look like, I don't know, Japan or China or whatever, people think they're a little old school, it's not like they're codifying in public, yeah, if you don't leave a bruise, just go to town on her. And they're calling it the slapping law. And,
yeah, I saw that.
And somebody said something like, it would be worse and more detrimental for a man to be humiliated by his wife than for a wife to be beaten by her husband. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? That's out of your fucking mind. But on the other hand, Russia's America's new best friend, so I guess I got to get married and beat up a woman.
I mean, we talked about it a little bit last week. Just don't touch people who don't want to be touched. Like, what the fuck? Like, whether you're going to punch a Nazi or slap your wife, don't do that. You know what I mean? Just, like, be normal. Don't hit people. Keep your hands to yourself. I tell my 3-year-old that. It's like, come on. It's bizarre. But, yeah, I was reading a little bit about, essentially, it decriminalizes. Anytime I hear decriminalize, I immediately think weed. But it decriminalizes a first offense of domestic violence that does not seriously injure the person, making it a less serious administrative offense. How you define what seriously injures someone is probably pretty vague and open to interpretation. But after the first offense, you get fined $507 and can be arrested for up to 15 days. Bizarre. I don't know why you would reduce that. It seems like a step backwards, but I'm probably just a Massachusetts liberal snowflake.
Yeah, you know, those of us here in America just don't understand the value of I remember Sean Connery said that in an interview with Barbara Walters. And like, he had said, you don't hit a woman, it's not right, blah, 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 but sometimes it's okay to slap her. And his argument was essentially, look, sometimes the argument's over and you don't care, but she just keeps yapping, and so you got to slap her to keep her quiet. And so Barbara Walters played this clip for him like 10 years later, and they said, she's like, so, you said this back then, but I'm sure, you know, since then you've changed your views and all this. And Sean Connery went, no, I still believe the exact same thing. Yeah, sometimes basically bitches have it coming. It's like, oh, okay then. I don't know what's wrong with you people, but you're idiots. Also, did you see the meme going around? I have to segue quick because I'm going to forget it. The fucking leftist anti-fascist fascists are publishing How to Punch a Nazi.
No.
Oh, my gosh. They have this deal, and I thought it was parody, but I guess it's actually real. I don't know. It's like, plan your escape, wear dark clothing, have a hoodie so you can't be identified, and then they legitimately said, when you make a fist, your thumb goes on the outside. If you need to be told that your thumb goes on the outside before you punch someone, you shouldn't be punching somebody.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Like,
that can't be real. That's got to be somebody making fun of it.
That's what I thought too. But like, I saw it. Like, I kept tracing it back. I'm like, seeing it.
It's like that. That's kind of funny because they're basically mocking the people who would go out and do that, claiming they don't even know how to throw a punch.
Which is like funny because they know how to.
This might be true.
They know how to, they know how to throw shit through a. I like when they throw things through a Starbucks. Like, really, dude that just came out and said, I'm going to hire 10,000 refugees. You're like, fuck you, Starbucks, and your overpriced coffee. Like, what political leanings do you people have? I don't even get it. It's Starbucks.
Yeah. I think people are confused about a lot of things in the world right now. But
mostly our president, yeah.
I was reading a little bit more up on this Russia thing. So this is from CNN, but official data, fake news, official data on domestic violence in Russia.
26,000 in a year, one-third of all women.
Yeah, 36,000 women are beaten by their husbands daily.
Yeah, so it is. What a
How is that possible? That's a lot. That's entire towns. Like, 36,000 women are beaten by their husbands daily, and 12,000 women die yearly as a result of domestic violence. One woman every 44 minutes.
It's just...
And they're loosening the laws. Like, what the hell kind of, you know, fucked up culture is that? That's fucked. That's, like, you know how you're supposed to, I forget what it is, cultural anthropology or whatever. Like, you're supposed to be understanding of other cultures because it's not your culture. You didn't grow up in it. It's a whole different part of the world. So it can be hard to understand other customs and societal norms, that sort of stuff. Like, I get that in theory, but you would think a country that's kind of sort of European, parts of it, in 2017 would be moving in the opposite direction, where they'd be coming down more on this and there'd be more publicity on this, but they're doing the opposite. It's like hard for me to understand the mindset or where they'd even be coming from, even if you try and put yourself in the worn shoes of a poor Russian man.
Well, I think you do see a split between Russia and the West in that.
Absolutely.
If it's a country where that many women are getting beaten every day, let's say it's only half that many, it's still a crazy number, well, of course they're going to decriminalize it. It is a cultural norm for them. It's a dumb cultural norm, and I think it's important that people stop saying things like, well, that's not my culture, so I can't judge it. No. Yes, you can. Like, there's just certain things, like, just have a set of balls and say, that's wrong. It's wrong to grab a woman, bring her into the town square, and stone her. It's wrong to throw a gay man off a building to kill him. I remember, it's a great story, and it was during the time when Britain occupied India. And even though there are people that didn't like the imperialism of it all, which I understand fine, but there was a British general, I think, was standing in a town square, and there was a big funeral pyre going because a man had died. And he saw that there was a woman looking very scared, and people were surrounding her and dancing or praying or some shit like that. Probably not dancing. They're Hindus. They don't dance. And he asked what was going on. He goes, this is the part where the wife has to throw herself in the funeral pyre, which is – that happens in the Hindu culture. That's not totally – I'm not making this shit up. And I don't know if she was happy about it, but they were going to throw her in there anyways. And he's like, you can't do that. And they go, well, that's just our culture. You can't judge us for it. And he looked at the man and goes, well, in my culture, if you throw a woman into a pit of fire, I kill you. So you do your culture and I'll do mine. So what I'm trying to say is, don't beat your wife.
Yeah, I won't. I promise. I don't want you to kill me. But the thing that's weird about it is over time things change. And the West looks, you know, wherever, the Middle East, where it might be, as this backward thing. And yeah, it is. Obviously, you shouldn't stone people. You shouldn't behead people because they're gay. I'm with you 100%. But to me, it's one of those things. Eventually, they'll come around to it. Like here, only, you know, 100 years ago, women couldn't vote. There were slaves 200 years ago or whatever, 250, whatever it might be. But the world changes, and not every part of the world is going to change at the same rate. But the fact that Russia's going backwards is the most bizarre part of it to me. You would think someday, I don't know if it's 50 years, 100 years, you know, some of the Middle East is going to change in advance and say, you know what, that's probably not right. We need to change it. And maybe I'm just being optimistic, but that's kind of how I roll. I think our country changes for the positive, and in general, the world eventually changes for the positive. It just might not happen as fast as we want it to.
And that's a fair thought, and that's basically a thought I've had for most of my life also. And it's kind of the idea that set aside Russia for a bit. They're weird. But Islam hasn't gone through its enlightenment yet.
Right.
And I wish I could take credit for this kind of thought process, but it was actually Sam Harris that said it. And it's the idea that that's true, and given enough time, the Middle East and the majority Muslim countries, and let's face it, it's sad, but every single majority Muslim country on the planet is backwards. They're just every single one of them have views on the world that are incompatible with modern Western thinking, not just Western thinking, but even, you know, the Far East and all, it's just logical thinking. But the problem is that we don't have the luxury of waiting around for them to figure things out, because there's a very good chance they'll get a nuclear weapon. And,
right.
And these are people who not only is killing the enemy a good thing, but dying in the process of killing the enemy is a good thing. They're not rational actors like Gorbachev or whomever in the Soviet Union, where they would be like, look, we don't want to die because we're running this shit. Like, these are people who want to die. They want to go out in a mushroom cloud. And that's our, I think, the big problem is that, yeah, they probably would come around. They probably would get it together, give it enough time, but they just came along the wrong time period where, thanks to Einstein, jerk, who didn't publish an autobiography, unlike Paige Van Zandt, we have the power of the atom, and, you know, one day it's going to happen. I mean, Pakistan has a nuclear weapon, and they're a majority Muslim country. They're moderate for now, but one day Iran's going to get that thing, and the world's going to have to basically make the decision of, do we let them exist with the ability to slowly stockpile enough weapons to kill us all, or do we make the decision to kill millions of people to save billions? I don't know. It's going to be shit, and I'm glad that I'm not in power. Unfortunately, Donald Trump is, and I don't think he wants to deal with that, but he probably won't have to. It'll probably be Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, assuming she's allowed to speak on the Senate floor in 2020.
Yeah, Bernie's too old. It's not going to be Bernie. That ship sailed. Anything else going on in the world? This show's been all over the place.
I don't know.
Russia, literally, it's been everywhere. It's been to the Middle East, Russia, Paige Van Zandt's house, everywhere.
I don't know, unless you want to talk about more of the things going on in the world. I don't care.
Okay. Neither. I don't care about what's going on in the world either.
Way too long, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So thanks for listening to MMA and stuff on halfguarded.com. I'm Matt. That's Mike. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about.
We hope you enjoy your stay. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day. We hope you enjoy your stay. Outside the sun is shining, seems like heaven ain't far away. It's good.